Rick Smith Show starts now.
Brothers, sisters, working class heroes, this is the Rick Smith Show on the road, the People's Tour for America. Today we're going to be talking about our interviews from Las Vegas, Nevada. We had such a great time in Vegas. I got to keep all of my money as well, but we had a great time talking with some really amazing people, and I want to jump right into it. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with a couple of the workers we met while in Las Vegas. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better. Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. The tour has taken us to Las Vegas, Nevada. We're sitting here in the AFSCME building. AFSCME Local 4041 has invited us to come in and talk to folks from across Las Vegas. I'm looking forward to the conversations we're going to have, Pat. Really, really hot stuff.
Hot stuff is right. You can bet on it. I love flying over Las Vegas. It's one of my favorite things to do when you're flying coast to coast because all of a sudden this place is in the middle of the desert. Yeah. But it happens when you're driving up to it, too.
Yeah, it was like, I thought it was a mirage.
Well, there's the mirage.
Or something.
And then there's the Bellagio. Yeah.
So
we're coming in, and I love Las Vegas. And I'm a tree-hugging hippie freak, and a lot of people are like, how can you love Las Vegas? It's because I don't just like teddy bears, bears and deer. I like people. And this is a big people playground, and it doesn't take care of itself. It doesn't build itself. It doesn't, you know, people have to do it. So we're going to talk to some of those people. And the most important thing of any civilized society, of course, is the government.
Yep.
The word I hate more than anything is bureaucrat. I hate that word. They aren't bureaucrats. They're civil servants. They do the work of the people. And they get crapped on by people for doing it. And one of those people crapped on is with us right now.
He's sitting here with us. He's an electrician over at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, UNLV. Also a member of AFSCME Local 4041. Harry, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Glad to do it.
You don't sound like someone from Las Vegas.
No, I come from New York, from Queens, New York. Born and raised there 36 years. I came out here around 96, so I've been in Vegas for about 16 to 17 years.
And what brought you out this way?
Work, looking for work, because it slowed down back in New York, and I was in and out of work for about 5 years, and finally it was booming out here at the time, and the family decided, the wife and I decided, well, I guess we'll pick up, we'll come out here and see if we can, make some money, that's the name of the game is, making money so you can pay your bills.
Right. So and also sweat a little bit.
Yes, it is hot.
But can you get a bagel with a schmear? That's the real question.
Well, you can get that, but I wouldn't actually call it a bagel with a schmear. Right? Let's see. Yeah,
pizza here.
Well, if they want to call it that, I kind of call it cardboard. But nothing against
pizza snob.
Well, New York has a right to be a pizza snob.
I'm with you. Hey.
I mean, it's one of the things I miss the most. Probably is the food. It was always great food back in New York. Great variety. So. Yeah.
So as we've been coming across the country, we're having the opportunity to sit down and talk with folks like you, you know, about the work you do, about why you're here, the history of your local of things going on out here, and you know, over at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, what is it that you do there?
Well, I'm a public servant. I work in the maintenance department, the facilities department out there, and as an electrician, you know. We go around, we make sure everything's lit, you know, we have to change out lights, have to change out the transformers for them, breakage trip, you do that, you make sure the electrical grid, everything's running safe, you know, that, you know, nobody gets electrocuted, you know, that's mainly my task.
You've got to be sucking down electricity like crazy keeping this place cool.
Well, they are, and I'm sure they do. And a big thing, a lot of times too, is you wonder, you know, some of the building designs that they've done out here. It's, you know, as you say, trying to keep a place cool during the summer or warm during the winter. You wonder why they would build some of these things, you know, totally glass or wide open ceiling spaces and things of that nature. Especially if it's a public building, you know, you kind of wonder that, but. You know, I guess there are higher people in the bureaucracy that make those decisions, that instead of talking to people that are actually doing the job.
Oh, yeah, that's a problem all the time.
And that's a problem all over, not just here.
Now, when you go to the for-profit places around here, like the casinos, I'm going to guess that you might have been in one.
Oh, yeah, once or twice, yes.
So when you've gone in, do you look around and say, well, this is obviously being built by people who have to pay the electric bill, or are they being built crazy too?
Well, out here, I mean, it's sort of a different world when it comes to, I guess, the casinos or the strip, because it always seems, to me anyway, you know, maybe it's because I'm coming from, you know, from a different locale when I first come here, but it just seems like everything out here is built for the glitz, it's built for the glow. I don't really think that there's a money aspect behind it when they are building out here. It's just that, you know, bigger, the better. The only place I can think of that possibly where they take some consideration and some thinking is when it comes to water conservation. And a lot of that might, you know, well, outside of us being in a desert and being in a drought for like the last 10 years, I think more of that is that they're more forced into that by the public entities than anything else. So.
Yeah, Lake Mead is a lot lower than it's supposed to be, that's for sure. I mean, you can see the watermark on everything. Yeah.
I mean, we were talking about it on the trip back, and originally Brett, the producer, said, you know, that's like 20 feet. I'm going, no.
No, it's not. It's like 70 feet, yeah.
Like 100 feet.
Yeah. And at first you look at it, you say, well, maybe it's a different rock formation, but you can look at Hoover Dam and see it's that low, too, with the watermarks on the dam as well. And now, you've been out here for a while, 15, so 17 years. First of all, when I was a kid, my mother said to us, be a plumber or an electrician, you'll always have work, right? So, but I'm hearing you say that you had to get out of New York because of what? There were too many electricians?
Well, I don't think it was so much there were too many electricians. I think it was more because of the economy. Back in, I guess, around the early 90s or 1990, again, the stock market, I believe, crashed, and so building crashed. A lot of it's similar to what happened here in around 2008 in Vegas, where a lot of projects just stopped. People stopped funding them, and so they stopped building. So you have to remember too, as far as you know, in a trade, is construction type work, it's always going to be on, you know, cyclic. So you know, it will you know, you'll have your boom and your bust. And as I was always told as I was coming up, to make sure that you know. You live on the wage that you're giving at the time. Don't live above it because, you know, you're going to get the lean times too, which is what happened. And because I worked union when I was back in New York. I came up through the IBEW. I did my apprenticeship through them. And, you know, and I was out of work, in and out of work for 5 years. And also I want to stress too is by being a union member, I was able to be given a letter of introduction to come to the local out here when I first came out here. So I was able to come out here, and not so much that I was guaranteed a job, but I was able to somewhat, you know, pretty much.
You know somebody.
Yes, basically, and, you know, that's what it is.
It's that brotherhood. It's that.
Exactly.
I did the same thing when I moved from Ohio to Pennsylvania. You
know, right, exactly.
You know, had the business agent call ahead and say, hey, do you have anything? Can you point someone in the right direction? And sometimes, you know, that's all you need.
Right, and being As I did get work out here, it did slow down out here, too, for a little bit.
Is anyone blaming you for that?
Yeah, I would.
I mean, everywhere he goes.
When he said that, I'm going, uh-oh. Where are you going next?
Well, that's just what it came down to.
I'm going to send him to China.
Well, luckily, how I got to where I am now, it was either one of the things, you know, you either sink or swim. So it was, you know, either going to pack up and go back to New York and, you know, and wait things out there, or, you know, you start putting applications in wherever you can, and which I did. You know, I did work non-union for a little while. I mean, I'm not proud of that.
What was the difference? What was the difference, the biggest difference you can say between a union job and a non-union job in Las Vegas?
Well, the first thing between a union is probably the pay. That would be the biggest thing. I mean,
obviously.
Since I started coming out west, I was taking a hit in pay, but everything, you know, everything's proportional, I guess. But the biggest thing was the pay. It must have been at least twice as much less than what union scale was. And then it's also a lot of it has to do with job conditions and things like that. You don't have that brotherhood feel. It's sort of, you're sort of on your own. Or you have the impression that you're on your own. You can be let go at any time. That's one of the problems with working in a bad period, being that it's a right-to-work state. You know, it's an at-will state. I mean, they don't like the way you look. You know, they can
Pennsylvania's the same way in the at-will portion.
Right.
If you don't have a union contract in Pennsylvania, you're out on your own. They don't even need a reason. There's the door. Don't let it hit you. Goodbye.
True. And you know, that's probably some of the biggest differences between here. It's just the way you work, I guess, is the way to put it.
So let me ask you this then, because, you know, you've highlighted a point that I've been making for quite some time. They keep saying, we're going to get these guys to work for less. So you worked for a non-union company that paid significantly less, as you pointed out. Are the building projects, in the grand scheme of things, are they significantly less? Because right now what they're talking about in our budget, in Pennsylvania's budget, they're saying, well, we want to do away with prevailing wage because it's going to save us 30%. We could save 30% on all of our building projects, even though labor is only about 18 to 20% of the total cost. I don't know where they're getting the number from, but they're saying 30% savings. When you took that huge pay cut, did the taxpayer, did the person paying the bill, did they save it, or did it just go into the contractor's pocket?
Well, it went to the contractor's pocket. I mean, in a roundabout way, you could say possibly the consumer was saving it. What happens when you're working for a non-union contractor, or if you're working where you don't have prevailing wage, is, you know, they can outbid you. The contractor, the non-union contractor can outbid the union contract. Of course, he can come in with a lower cost. But even if he does, I mean, how much of a percentage of that is he going to do? I mean, you know, I've worked on jobs, even if they were union jobs, I've lost money. I lost money on this job. He still made, $20,000, but he projected to make 22. So I lost money on the job,
yep,
because I lost $2,000. Whatever the reason might have been. I mean, it could have been, you know, there was an overcourse or something, you know, or he had to use more men than he was planning on it. But the same thing applies. I mean, the non-union contractor can come and say, all right, this guy bid $20,000. The union contractor bid $20,000. I can do it for 18. So I mean, if you're a business owner, or if you're a homeowner, or you're going to go with the lower cost. But, you know, what's happening is a member of the community, because that's what we all are as workers, we're members of the community, they're losing out because now they have less money to spend in the community. So, I mean, you know, it's a circle. It all comes around. So, I mean, if you're going to start cutting certain people out of it, then, you know, it's going to end up getting shorter. Somebody's going to get richer. Somebody's going to get, you know, somebody's going to lose out. I mean, and that's similar to what's happened to state employees,
right,
over the last 4 years since 2008, whereas, you know, because we do not have a collective bargaining agreement, everything that we gain or we lose comes through the legislature, And yeah, that's what they would do. And they were, you know, they cut our salaries. They hit us with furloughs. They stopped our merit pay. They stopped our longevity pay. And, you know, and that was just to state employees. And that was so that they could balance a budget. But when you look at the grand scheme of things, and you, where's the logic in this? Because we live in a consumer economy. So, and especially Nevada, everything in Nevada, you know, is based on what's being bought because the majority of their money
the majority
of their money comes from sales taxes. I mean, a large majority comes from the tax, from people coming to the casinos, from people going to the store and buying. So what do you do? If you have a 20,000 workforce of state employees, and now you just cut them upwards over the course of 4 years, 25%, that's 25% less buying power. So where's the thought process in this? Because now you have 20,000 people who are going to end up not going to the movies, maybe not going out to eat, possibly not going up to the strip, having to, you know, cutting their cable bills back or whatever. I mean, you know, and outside is just the weight or the problem that it puts on the families, because now they have to do without because they're making less money.
My mom was a state employee the first time the first time they furloughed employees. And I'll tell you what, you never saw a woman so angry. And she was good at getting angry, but she exceeded anybody's expectation with her anger on this one. And she was an auditor for the state. So that meant she brought in money. So they furloughed people who were bringing in money, which was even stupider, like you're saying, though, no sales tax revenue, right? But anyway, a group of Maine state employees went to attorneys because they felt it was unconstitutional to balance the state budget on a subsection of people. You can't balance a budget on a selected group of people. And they, you know, obviously you're up against the judges, but I want to know why state employees aren't doing that all over the country, because when you furlough employees, you make the state budget go on just one subgroup, and it's always seemed to make sense to me.
Good point, because one of the points that I brought out, or many of us have brought out, is because as we were all leading up to this, and you know, our legislators, our governor, they're all, we cannot raise taxes. But yet, what they did, or what we feel they did, is they raised taxes on a select, as you were saying, a select group of individual people, or a select group. They raised taxes on state workers by furloughing them, by cutting their pay, by taking their merit away from them, by taking their longevity away from them, you know, doing a number of different things just to balance the budget. But yet they don't call that a tax, but that is a tax, because myself and the rest of my fellow state employees, we were the only ones who had to pay this.
Yeah, and supposedly it's unconstitutional. If somebody could get the money together to fight that, it would not hold, and then a state would have to find a more fair and equitable way of changing the revenue stream than just taking it out of one group of people.
Exactly, and I mean that's something that we would look forward to. That's something we would try to push ourselves. But again, you know, it takes a lot to money, people. It takes a lot to do, you know, to push these type of issues forward, and you know, just to get the public behind you to do these kind of things. Because at the same time, you know, a lot of people just that, you know, they look at state employees feeding at the public trough and things like that. I don't believe that for a minute, because I mean, when you have cuts, when you have staff cuts, and you're not filling positions, you know, you are putting not just, you know, the worker themselves within many of our agencies, corrections, mental health, but you're also putting the inmates or other civilian employees in these agencies, the patients, you're putting them at risk also, because you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, we've had people, you know, employees that have been, you know, been attacked personally, you know, by inmates, by patients in a lot of the mental hospitals that we have, even in the youth correctional facilities, where they're because they're understaffed, you have, and they can get away and do this.
You know, we just before the Screwquester went into effect in Pennsylvania, there was a guy who was a federal corrections officer putting away prisoners by himself, and he was beaten to death. And you know, you look at this and you go, it speaks volumes to what you're saying here, because you know, I look at this lack of investment and this very short-sightedness. And while, you know, a number of unions have gone and done what you suggested, Pat. Our courts aren't maybe as enlightened as the Massachusetts courts, but that's been done across the country in a number of places.
And it needs to be taken higher. I mean, that's the problem. And that's when they say, just another example, you know, they want to drug test food stamp recipients. When you talk about that being unconstitutional, there's going to be somebody willing to pay for the court process. You know, and so that's the problem, is when they fail in their local courts, because they are, in many cases, kangaroo courts, you can't get beyond it to the next level because, you know, whether it's the union or whomever, they just don't have the money to do it. And it's really ridiculous because states are put above everything. Like, you can't sue the state without the permission of the legislature. How can that be? It's so stupid, but it is. It's an entity in and of itself.
Exactly. I mean, well, in cases like that, I mean, they put these laws in place just to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, you can't come after them when they're doing something wrong. And they make the process so much more difficult then, because then you have to go through the legislative process and get everybody, you know, get people behind you, get the legislature behind you, and to write these into laws. And, you know, lately, you know, what I can tell, with all the money that's spent by all these sources that, you know, that are anti-labor, you know, they're outspending, you know, labor or the individual to get laws written that, you know, basically help them.
Well, you look at ALEC. I mean, you look at all the ALEC legislation and all that going on. You know, all the attacks that we've been talking about in Pennsylvania and have gone on for here for years, and, you know, where they want to lead us in Pennsylvania is right here.
One of the things you brought up was the fact that people, you have to need public opinion on your side. Now, when you started out working as a labor union member and as an electrician, has public sentiment turned against unions in your lifetime? And then how do we turn it back?
I would say, I don't know so much if public sentiment has turned against labor. I think a lot of it is that the majority of the public just does not understand what a union is, what labor is, and, you know, and what it does and what it's there for. I think it's more that I don't want to call the public uneducated, but I just think that they just don't.
It's not a matter of uneducated. They've never had the opportunity to have it put in front of them, because you look at our school structure, there's no labor education.
Exactly. Because, you know, like I said, when I came up, part of the thing when I came up through my IBEW union back in, I mean, I just didn't learn how to be, you know, electrical theory, be an electrician. I also had to go to labor college. I had to learn the history of labor and do labor studies. And I don't know too many different, I don't know if there are any other locals, whether it be the electrical local or any other locals out there, that take the time out to teach people, you know, the history of labor. And I mean, that's where I mean, because before that, I knew nothing about unions. I didn't, you know, what's a union, you know, just group some out there or whatever. And through that, I learned the history of labor, and I learned what, you know, labor actually did in this country, what labor had to fight for in this country. And, you know, I mean, it wasn't just like somebody handed something to us. We had to go out and do it. And I find that, you know, and again, I mean, when you have two forces that are fighting each other. You have a force that is looking to do, you know, to benefit, you know, members in labor, benefit the working people. And you have the force of whatever you want to call them, capitalists, you want to call them multinationalists, whatever you want to call them, that are out there looking, you know, their thing is to make a profit. And one of the ways to make a profit is off the back of a person working.
Screwing you.
So, well, that's it. And that's what they do. So, you know, again, when, you know, so much, I don't think it was so much that, the public has turned against workers. I just don't think they understand workers or what a union, the benefits of a union. And there really is, unless you go out there yourself to find it, there isn't anybody out there telling you what it is. Like, there's no curriculum in school that teaches you it.
So you've got 90 seconds. Tell people what a labor union is.
Well, a labor union is no different than any other organization you do. A labor union is a group of people that are out there working for your benefit. They are working to, whether it be pay raises, whether it be safety in the workplace, whether it be benefits such as pensions. They are looking out for your interest. They are looking out for a worker's interest. They're not looking out for the boss's interest. They're looking out for your interest. It's no different than a business that belongs to a chamber of commerce. same thing. You join it, and like any industry or any group organization you belong to, it needs funds, and that's what the union dues is. It's a fund to keep your union operating. It doesn't go to politics. It doesn't go to pay for the legislature. It goes to operate your union. So, I mean, if you want to work better, if you want to work smarter, join a union.
I can't do any better than that.
I'm thrilled.
Harry Shiffman, I appreciate you taking time for us.
I thank you. I was happy to be here.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Going to take a quick break from Nevada here in Las Vegas, here in Nevada. Quick break, right back. The People's Tour for America. Stick around. Right back.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
What do you give a guy who has everything?
Labor history, of course.
And where can you get a great dose of labor history?
Right here, weeknights from 9 to midnight on The Rick Smith Show.
From New York City factories to West Virginia coal mines to Oregon loading docks to Toledo glass factories, you'll hear all the stories right here, right up until the new year.
And then we'll be back with all new shows here on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. As the U.S. Senate struggles to pass immigration reform in a form that will also pass the House, the AFL-CIO is reminding lawmakers that Americans in all but paper deserve a path to citizenship. The Labor Federation says immigrants should not be forced to run an obstacle course. The AFL-CIO says it opposes any amendments to the bill that, quote, impose hard triggers whose real purpose and real impact will be to close off the opportunity for eligible immigrants to become citizens, end quote. Meanwhile, SEIU Secretary Treasurer Eliseo Medina says a CBO score on the immigration reform bill shows it's good for the U.S. economy by reducing the deficit and increasing the gross domestic product. A 17-day, 15-city, coast-to-coast Summer of Solidarity tour is planned for later this summer as local union activists and community allies support local struggles, connecting them with the broader fight against corporate power. United Steelworker Union locals and the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America will kick off that tour August 17th in Philadelphia, wrapping it up on Labor Day in Los Angeles. More information at summerofsolidarity.org. As the Netroots Nation Conference kicks off in San Jose, members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus will join workers to launch a Raise Up America campaign in support of the low-wage worker movement. It's aimed at raising pay for American workers to get the economy moving again for everyone. Low-wage workers, supported by unions like SEIU, Unite Here, and UFCW, are pushing for higher wages and the right to form unions in cities from New York City and Chicago to Seattle. Striking banana workers are awaiting word from Del Monte on reinstating 59 fired workers. Jesse Russell reports.
Today is the ninth day of a strike by more than 650 banana workers in Costa Rica. The workers walked off the job due to Banana Development Company, a Del Monte subsidiary, firing 59 workers. Those workers were part of a strike in 2011, which resulted in the company negotiating a contract that included provisions saying it would not retaliate against workers who took part in strike actions. A judge has since ruled that 2011 strike illegal. Due to the current strike, three banana plantations are currently paralyzed, and the workers are calling on other plantations to join their protest. The workers have also taken to the streets, disrupting traffic on Thursday and Friday of last week. Del Monte is currently in negotiations regarding the worker demands to have the fired employees reinstated, but to date, the company has publicly reaffirmed it stands by its decision.
Workers Independent News is underwritten in part by the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and the OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. You can also check out the website, The People's Tour for America. You know, one of the things, Pat, that Harry there hit on that I think is extremely important is this idea that with the prevailing wage argument that the contractors, they're going to be the ones that pocket the wage difference. Mm. And we've seen it time and time again, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Utah, everywhere where they've talked about and they've done even the smallest repeal of prevailing wage, what we saw is the bids didn't come down, but the wages sure did.
Yeah, and if it's not the contractor that pockets it, it's just the guy doing the job. You know, I mean, the owner. I could see where, you know, if it's a government job, it's the contractor, and if it's any other kind of a job, it's a private industry job, then, well, private industry's just getting fatter. You know, so it doesn't matter if it's a state worker like this or if it's just a general a tradesman in general. If you don't have somebody that's getting a decent wage, that money's not being saved by anybody. It's going into a pocket.
Yeah, and, you know, that's the thing that, you know, the Tea Party think tank loves to say, oh, you're going to save 30%. And, you know, as we said, you know, that's just it's just wrong math. I mean, when you're talking about labor costs somewhere between 18 and 20% of any building project, saving 30% would mean, well, that would mean all the workers would have to pay. And I know that's what conservatives would love to see. I know that's what the Tea Party think tank would love to see, is you and me having to pay for the privilege of working. But the reality is it's fabricated. It's made up. It's BS. But they keep like the big lie theory. They keep just repeating it ad nauseum.
I'm worried about shattering your inner belief in humanity. But are you ready for this?
Hit me.
Mathematicians and scientists, not so much Tea Party. Okay, they aren't a bunch of guys who know how to run an abacus. You know what I'm saying? If they get their math wrong, I think you should just count on it. They weren't the kid in school that said, hey, teacher, can I write this problem on the board?
Yeah, good point.
You know, if you can do math, you don't join the Tea Party.
Excellent point. Let's take a quick break right back from Nevada, Las Vegas. Right back after this. Happy holidays, everyone. I'm Rick Smith, and I'd like to invite you to tune in here each and every night through the remainder of 2013 for encore performances of our People's Tour for America.
And I'm Pat LaMarche. I traveled with Rick and his family this past summer on the People's Tour, and we met some pretty amazing folks. So from now until 2014, you'll be able to hear those folks tell their story of how the middle class grew in their part of America. Join us right here weeknights from 9 till midnight.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. As the U.S. Senate struggles to pass immigration reform in a form that will also pass the House, the AFL-CIO is reminding lawmakers that Americans in all but paper deserve a path to citizenship. The Labor Federation says immigrants should not be forced to run an obstacle course. The AFL-CIO says it opposes any amendments to the bill that, quote, impose hard triggers whose real purpose and real impact will be to close off the opportunity for eligible immigrants to become citizens, end quote. Meanwhile, SEIU Secretary Treasurer Eliseo Medina says a CBO score on the immigration reform bill shows it's good for the U.S. economy by reducing the deficit and increasing the gross domestic product. A 17-day, 15-city, coast-to-coast Summer of Solidarity tour is planned for later this summer as local union activists and community allies support local struggles, connecting them with the broader fight against corporate power. United Steelworker Union locals and the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America will kick off that tour August 17th in Philadelphia, wrapping it up on Labor Day in Los Angeles. More information at summerofsolidarity.org.
As the Netroots Nation Conference kicks off in San Jose, members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus will join workers to launch a Raise Up America campaign in support of the low-wage worker movement. It's aimed at raising pay for American workers to get the economy moving again for everyone. Low-wage workers, supported by unions like SEIU, Unite Here, and UFCW, are pushing for higher wages and the right to form unions in cities from New York City and Chicago to Seattle. Striking banana workers are awaiting word from Del Monte on reinstating 59 fired workers. Jesse Russell reports.
Today is the ninth day of a strike by more than 650 banana workers in Costa Rica. The workers walked off the job due to Banana Development Company, a Del Monte subsidiary, firing 59 workers. Those workers were part of a strike in 2011, which resulted in the company negotiating a contract that included provisions saying it would not retaliate against workers who took part in strike actions. A judge has since ruled that 2011 strike illegal. Due to the current strike, three banana plantations are currently paralyzed, and the workers are calling on other plantations to join their protest. The workers have also taken to the streets, disrupting traffic on Thursday and Friday of last week. Del Monte is currently in negotiations regarding the worker demands to have the fired employees reinstated, but to date, the company has publicly reaffirmed it stands by its decision.
Workers Independent News is underwritten in part by the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and the OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Hi, I'm Rick Smith.
And I'm Pat LaMarche.
We're not here right now. You're
really?
No, not right now. Maybe in a little bit.
That's because you're listening to an encore performance of our People's Tour for America.
Is that what we're doing?
Yeah, Rick and the kids, along with our producer Brett and I, took a trip across the country this year in search of real stories about what made America great.
We met some really great historians, organizers, and activists with great stories to tell.
We hope you enjoy them.
The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
How do we explain the heat? One word. Summer.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here in Las Vegas, Nevada on the People's Tour for America. And if you want to find out where we've been, where we're going, peoplestourforamerica.com, the website, you can find out who we've spoken to and all the topics, all the pictures, all the things we've done so far. And we've been, Pat.
I was going to say, I had a picture of my lunch up there.
Nice.
We went to this Mexican place. Fab. I tried my Spanish on them.
Instead of the People's Tour for America, it's going to be the Waistline Tour of America.
Oh, my God. We've only got 8,000 miles. My Waistline Tour, I could do that twice.
Oh, I tell you, I can't wait to get out of this heat, though.
I know.
Insane.
These people are amazing that live in this kind of heat. Tanya.
Yes. Hello.
How do you tolerate heat? Are you from here originally?
No, from Michigan, but I've been out here since I was 11 years old, so you can say that I'm from here. Yes.
Really? They don't let you do that in Maine. In Maine, they say if you weren't born there, they say just because a cat had kittens in the oven, don't make them biscuits.
Yeah.
Okay.
It didn't make sense to me either, but I'm not from Maine. I moved there when I was older.
Okay. Well, I tolerate the heat by staying inside.
That's one way to do it?
Which we just learned you can't do if you're homeless. You don't have an inside.
No, you don't.
Yeah. Well, you work with another group of people. You work with other people who could have a tough time of it, and that's the elderly. I guess we should introduce her.
Yeah, I mean, we're sitting here with Tanya Jones. She's an APSME, Local 40, 41 member. Also, she's the chair of the Community Connections Committee, which I definitely want to look into once we get past the dealing with the aged folks, because you work in the Department of Aging, correct?
That's correct. Division of Aging, we deal with people who are 65 years and older, who need assistance within their home. We have quite a few programs. We have the CHIPS program. We also have the assistant living program, and we also have the group home program.
What is CHIPS?
CHIPS, basically it's a program to assist people within their home. So it's community-based program that we assist people within their home, for instance, with their activities of daily living, what we call ADL, and basically helping them in the restroom, out, basically things that we take for granted each day, what they're not able to do, that's what our program assists with.
And that would probably be a good thing, instead of warehousing people in nursing homes and places like that, to keep folks in their homes, it's got to be more cost effective as well.
That's correct.
As well as give people dignity of staying in their homes.
That's right.
Now, do you subcontract the workers who go to do that?
The personal care workers, yes, we do. Yes, we do. We have Medicaid-certified agencies that we contract out to do that particular work. And we basically monitor them, audit their ins and outs, basically how they're treating the clients within their home and if they're following the rules and regulations of Nevada State.
This is the thing states have done all across the country, though, where they get contractors to do this work, and then the contractors can pay basically minimum wage for a person who's so important to the elderly. I mean, this is a person who literally, yeah, and states not wanting to pay adequate pay and adequate benefits to people allow this sort of contracted work to go through. And it's how, frankly, governors have gotten elected for the last 20 years by promising to cut the workforce of the state employees.
And, you know, that is correct, because through Clark County, you know, they have their PCA, their personal care aide workers within their agency, and we do contract out. But that's one thing what our agency does. Each social worker has a caseload of about 50 clients, and so we call those clients once a month, and we actually go and see them, and we audit the agencies. Now, no, we're not in there as much as the personal care aide, you know, agencies.
How many employees would you have to hire in order for the state to provide this service?
At least 1,000. You're referring to the PCA, the personal care aide? Well, I guess it depends. We have about each social worker, and we have about, in my office, the Division of Aging, we have about 20 social workers there, and then each social worker has 60 people that they tend to, and so, but one of the PCA agencies, the personal care aide, they can do around 3 or 4. So, no, probably about a couple of hundred.
So a couple hundred more state employees to make sure that that employee that's going to help the elderly gets a
my
decent wage. Right.
My grandmother.
Yeah, gets a decent wage, can afford daycare or child care for their child. I mean, the better things that a person should deserve when they're basically a state employee, but the state's found a way to be cheap.
And that is a huge issue, because we do have personal care aide people who the social workers find out that they're stealing from, you know, the elderly person, or and there's a lot of financial abuse, and we have a whole department, you know, that deals with that. And actually that this last couple of years, because of the pay cuts and so forth, that came up a lot, you know, with the state cracking down on fraud abuse, which it should have been cracking down a long time ago, and we probably wouldn't have been able to have.
And the other part of this is you pay them a decent wage, you give them decent benefits, maybe they won't steal. Maybe the temptation won't be there, because remember, they've got kids, they've got family, they've got elderly at home that they've got to take care of.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
The temptation won't be there, or the necessity, you know. I mean, I was amazed. Les Mis comes out, and, you know, what's his name? Hugh Jackman plays the lead, right? And every American's like falling all over themselves to go see that movie. It's about a guy who goes to jail for stealing a loaf of bread, America. It's about what you're doing in this country right now. You're throwing people in jail for stealing a loaf of bread, and then you're not wondering why, you know.
But many bankers have gone to jail? Because of the collapse in 2008. I mean, here in Las Vegas, here in Nevada, the reality is that this is one of the states hit hardest by the foreclosure, by the housing bubble. And
that's
would think
right.
People would be screaming, let's hang people, let's flogging something,
right?
Cane them.
Yeah, you know that's right. You know, with the housing bubble, it seems as though it's kind of like retracting itself. You know, right now they say it's a seller's, you know, market, and so now a lot of the investors, they're coming back and they're buying up the homes again, just as they were doing before, and they're hiking the prices back up, and so that all goes into, you know, state workers getting a pay cut because of situations like this, you know, getting back into the same tune. Things have to change.
Yeah, I'm with you. And you look at all across the country, all these budget cuts, and we were talking before, you said there was a huge cut here to the state workers' pay over the years. And as you take that money away from those workers, it comes out of the community, and it's like a spiraling down effect.
It's a trickle-down effect. That is correct. It all trickles down, you know, because we're one community. And then so what happens to the state workers, we're in the community, so therefore if we're not able to afford our house payment, what's going to happen? We're going to get foreclosed on, you know, and then thereafter we're going to have to, you know, do other things in order to survive. And it's all a trickle-down effect. Then it affects our kids. Then we're having to go and get second jobs in order to afford the same things that we had before. You know, you don't see a lot of state workers, you know, with Mercedes and things like that.
I don't think I've ever seen one. But, you know, you listen to the mainstream corporate-controlled for-profit media, and they'll be happy to tell you that it's folks like you who crashed the economy in 2008. You greedy pensioner, people who want pensions and health care and wages. It's your fault.
We want to live, and we want to live comfortably, and we want to...
you mean you don't want to have to get food stamps? You mean
no,
you don't want to get your
and we don't
want to
feel like we're being taken advantage of. You know, we don't want to feel that way. We don't want to feel like we're, because we're state workers, you know, we're basically the baggage. We don't want to feel like that, you know, and that's what's happened in the last couple of years and before. And we're tired of that.
I don't know how you do it. I mean, like, same thing with teachers.
Now, you've done this. You've said you've worked in a lot of social services because you're a social worker. How long have you done the elderly part?
The elderly part since 2008.
Have you seen a change? I mean, is it worse than it was in 2008 was right at the cusp. That's right when the economy crashed. Has it gotten worse for the elderly in Nevada since you got this job? Not that those two are related.
No, it's actually gotten better, and the reason why it's gotten better because the state then said, okay, well, where's all our money going to? Then everything, all of a sudden, they wanted to crack down on every penny, which those things, just like you were talking about, contracting out. They were contracting out to agencies that weren't doing anything. We were duplicating services. There were so many things that was going on within the system that should have been stopped a long time ago. But administration did not stop that. So then when we got into a situation that we needed money, then, they made the fraud unit larger. And so, no, it's gotten better because now everything is cracked down on, which is better for the elderly.
So what I'm hearing is they had private contractors. And they were being cheated by the private contractors.
So the
corporate owners of these private contractor companies were cheating the state. And that's what was going on when there was a lot of money.
And now we've
not
got a
government.
Not
the little guy. Not that the little guy was screwing the state. Not the little old person that needed something was. But that the contractors.
And now we've got a governor in Pennsylvania who wants to go and do what Nevada undid, which is privatize all of those things, give it to the private contractors so that we could experience what you guys experienced.
Right. So there's still a lot of contracting, but a lot of those agencies that weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing are now out of there.
They're in jail? The owners of those companies are in jail?
I'm not sure of that, if they're in jail.
They should be.
Yeah, but they're not.
I do know at least two personal care aide people who are in jail.
Oh, yeah, the minimum wage employee went to jail.
The people at the bottom, right?
Yeah. That's right.
Those people went to jail, but the guys who had them, you know where they are now? Arizona! Hey, Wyoming, how's it going?
Yeah, or they changed their name, the company name.
Exactly.
Join it with someone else.
File bankruptcy, change the name. Like the guy...
Like in West Virginia.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what happened. And so, for the elderly, it's gotten better in that kind of way for the families.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, there's something positive.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Tanya Jones. She's an AFSCME member, Local 4041 here in Las Vegas, Nevada. She's also the chair of the Community Connections Committee from AFSCME. Tell me, what is the Community Connections Committee? What do you do?
Basically, it's built to become more visible in the community so people see what AFSCME members are doing out in the community. For instance,
besides destroying the economy?
Right. We want, because a lot of people, unfortunately, for instance, some of my coworkers, you know, social workers and other people see it as a negative, you know, being part of the union. Like you're making a fuss, you're trying to fight against something, and you're making a ruckus instead of fixing things, instead of helping, instead of being the voice for other people. And so the Community Connections Committee is basically out there to show how we're doing things in the community, you know, helping. For instance, we assisted a couple of weeks ago along with the United Way in cleaning up around one of the schools around here, and we wore our shirts and so forth. And also we invited non-members, and so they can see what we're doing, and then so they can join so we can increase our membership.
You know, that's really important because even though you've been doing great stuff all the time, if you don't blow your own horn, you know, that's why we're doing this trip. Because somebody's got to tell people. Hey.
Absolutely.
And this trip is great because we keep talking to people like you. I mean, I've done a lot of these crazy trips where I get to talk to people and about things that are really sad. And the best thing about this trip is every single place we went, we met a person, even laid off union employees who had somebody to lean on. You know, it's not like talking to the average person who's got nobody.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, we thank you for that, going around and doing this and letting us, you know, speak our voice. We appreciate that.
Yeah, well, you know what I find, though, in talking to union members and having been a Teamster for 20 years myself, mm-hmm. I find that union members tend to not like to be steamrolled and pushed around, and that they're willing to stand. They're the ones who are willing to stand up, which is why the Koch brothers spend so much money and the Diane Hendricks of the world and the billionaire class in this country do so mm-hmm. much to try and destroy unions, because it's those union members who are going to stand up and say that's not right because it's part of their culture.
Right, right. Yeah, that's right. And, you know, that was one of the reasons why I've always been for unions, and I really got involved back in 2004 when I first became a social worker. I worked over at the Division of Welfare and Supportive Services, and it seems as though we were administering policies that were hindering the people instead of helping them. And so the social workers, you know, we were helping, and the eligibility workers, everyone was helping and advocating for the clients. But then when it came time, you know, that administration was stating, you know, that, okay, now you guys are getting a pay cut, you know, changing our hours without asking, you know, hey, is this going to be okay, or do you guys have any other suggestions? No one wanted to speak up for, you know, for the employees. You know, everyone basically became compliant. Everyone, you know, just stated, okay, well, you know, this is what we do. This is what happens. No, this is not what happens. You know, somebody has to speak up. And once one person starts and then other people who have that same mission, who are thinking the same thing, you know, then they get on board and then they started also. And, you know, that was one of the reasons, because I couldn't believe all the compliancy, everyone just stating, you know, no. And that's when I made a pact to myself. I'm always going to, you know, say my voice, you know, and get out there. And because once I say my voice, other like-minded people are going to come to me and joining up, you know, with AFSCME and a union. That's what we do. You know, having more than one voice, you know, that's what puts the power into play.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. That's an excellent point. You and your coworkers spent all this time advocating for other people, but when someone needed to advocate for you, nobody said anything. They didn't advocate for themselves. Yeah.
They said, well, I have a job. I'm okay. You know, and I think that's what's happened, you know, over the years, you know, from the 1960s, you know, that fear factor, you know, community activists like Saul Alinsky, you know, people like that. It's just like going out there fighting. But, you know, what happens? They got, you know, blackballed and different things like that, you know, because of the things they were doing out in the community. And I think over the years, you know, people have gotten scared and, you know, they've not wanted to advocate for themselves. And it's unfortunate.
Which is why I think it's vitally important
that's correct.
You have yep. community connection organizations mm-hmm. and not just for members, that you're involving the entire community, because, you know, as a kid, you know, I saw the union, I saw the Teamsters especially, as that ticket to the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
The message to me was union equals middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Today what's going on is the wealth class, in their divisive tactics, have equated unions to, well, to thugs and to greedy people, and there really hasn't been that pushback to say, wait a minute.
Right.
Where's
right.
the sane, rational thought in saying, just because I want to be able to feed my family and be able to have some a decent retirement and some security and health, how does that make me the person who collapsed the economy when you've got people stealing billions and billions of dollars and not being held accountable for it?
Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree. And that's the reason why we have to get out there and show, you know, what we do in a positive manner.
So when you're out there talking to community people who don't know anything about unions, and I find as
mm-hmm.
we go across the country and the more people we talk to,
mm-hmm.
that they really don't have an opinion other than what's been fed to them in the mainstream medium, which tends to be negative.
Right.
What kind of response do you get from people when they go, well, I never thought of you, Tanya, as one of those union thugs?
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, you know, I go into the representation. You know, basically, as a union representative and a union worker and me personally, you know, I tell them, you know, hey, who's going to fight for us? You know, it's like you have to have more than one person, you know, in order to get up in front of the legislature and talk to our legislators, you know, so they can get on our side. And so they know, you know, what's going on,
yeah.
you know. because, you know, they're not aware. And so basically I advise them what, you know, how the union represents, because, you know, we have lobbyists, you know, who go up and talk to the, our legislators, and then, and we call our legislators, you know, we write letters to our legislators, you know, we invite them over to our home. So we do all that within our community. And so without that, without the union, you know, we wouldn't have all that. You know, we don't have time to, you know, to go up there and do that and do, you know, the lobby work with they're there constantly pounding on them when the session is open. You know, it's like, you know, we need more people. And so that's what I tell them.
To hold them accountable.
That's right.
And, you know, to answer the question, who's going to fight for us? We're going to fight for us.
Exactly. Exactly.
Except that, that she's also fighting for everybody who doesn't fight for themselves. And that's the same, too, is I think a lot of people in the workplace forget where they got the weekend, forget where they got the 40-hour work week, forget where they got the minimum wage, forget why kids aren't working next to them. Why isn't there a 9-year-old? And then, like you say, their hands are little. They do all kinds of neat stuff. You don't have a child working next to you. Of course, they've outsourced slavery to Bangladesh now. But we're doing that as much as we can, and the people who are fighting for all that are the union workers.
That's right, the union workers, and that's what we're doing, out there showing our voice and stating what we're what needs to be changed.
And the other reason people... It's so funny because he is exactly what you picture when you think of a union member, isn't he?
Yes, with the nice shirt and the, yeah, and the railroad
you know,
hat.
The big ready smile, but the great 6'30", you know, giant guy, you know, who drives a truck and all that. That's what you think of. And when you meet a petite, beautiful young woman, you're like, oh, that's not him, somebody from a union.
That's
and,
why I asked her.
And know? That's what's happened all across the country. We keep meeting all these really neat people who don't look like they belong in a union, and we've got to get your faces out there.
Yeah, I mean, I look like the Hollywood teamster, but I just need a bat.
Wait a minute, you have a bat?
I've got tons of them, but I have one with me now.
That's good to know.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You know, these issues happen to us all, you know.
Yep.
It's like someone can't just, you know, the administrators just can't come in, you know, in a factory, you know, anywhere and just state, you know, and put
impose.
Down rules and regulations, impose, you know, regulations that is unsafe. You know, they just can't do that. You know, it's been happening for a long time, yep. and that's why we're here, you know, to fight for those rights.
And, you know, I say it all the time, you know, the workplace and its concept is a dictatorial place. You
mm-hmm.
walk in, it's, you know, the Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Law actually has in master and servant. That's how the law views employee-management relations.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a wow.
It is a wow.
Yeah.
And it's only through organizing, it's only through collective bargaining, it's only through bringing people together that you can have any pushback to that kind of dictatorial power.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I think that's exactly what you've pointed out. And we really appreciate you taking time for us and sharing your stories with us.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys coming.
Thank you so much, Todd.
I have one more very quick question.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I know. But it's really quick. Is there something people could do to help you with this community outreach? I mean, you've got to get, we're trying to get the word out, but we're not doing very well either.
Mm-hmm.
What can people, the average person, even if they're not, if they're just a little old lady who's got 10 extra hours in a week, how can people help you guys get the word out?
Mm-hmm. They can come out and, you know, they can come out and help us with our community events, you know, that we have. We do post those, you know, on the internet, on our Facebook, you know, through Ask Me. And so have you guys posted the stated the website address?
Not yet. Go ahead.
Okay, good, good. Okay. It's Denise, our organizer.
Well, the international is AskMe.org.
Yes.
And in our area, AskMe Council 13, AskMe13.org is their website as well, one of our big sponsors.
And we'll get Mary to make sure that, yeah, one of our big sponsors. But we'll get Mary to make sure that the local here is on, too, so that people can make sure. Mary's back in Pennsylvania typing as we speak, making sure that that's all on there, too. I just didn't know if there was something special for you guys that where you post those actions that you do.
We do post them on our website. We post the events on our website as well. And so and our email address is www.nvasme, which is AFSCME.org. And we post those on there for our community events. Please
go.
Come out. That'll be great. And to show your support, and if you're a state worker, to become a member. Thank you.
To the streets, as I always say. Tanya, thanks so much. Quick break. Right back with the People's Tour for America. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
I'm Pat LaMarche, and you're listening to an encore performance of the People's Tour for America. That's when Rick and I and the whole Rick Smith Show took off across the country to learn about labor history. Rick, what are you doing here?
I just popped in to see how the encore performances were going.
Go on vacation already. We'll be back after the new year with all new shows.
Weeknights, 9 to midnight, the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
As the U.S. Senate struggles to pass immigration reform in a form that will also pass the House, the AFL-CIO is reminding lawmakers that Americans in all but paper deserve a path to citizenship. The Labor Federation says immigrants should not be forced to run an obstacle course. The AFL-CIO says it opposes any amendments to the bill that, quote, impose hard triggers whose real purpose and real impact will be to close off the opportunity for eligible immigrants to become citizens, end quote. Meanwhile, SEIU Secretary Treasurer Eliseo Medina says a CBO score on the immigration reform bill shows it's good for the U.S. economy by reducing the deficit and increasing the gross domestic product. A 17-day, 15-city, coast-to-coast Summer of Solidarity tour is planned for later this summer as local union activists and community allies support local struggles, connecting them with the broader fight against corporate power. United Steelworker Union locals and the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America will kick off that tour August 17th in Philadelphia, wrapping it up on Labor Day in Los Angeles. More information at summerofsolidarity.org. As the Netroots Nation Conference kicks off in San Jose, members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus will join workers to launch a Raise Up America campaign in support of the low-wage worker movement. It's aimed at raising pay for American workers to get the economy moving again for everyone. Low-wage workers, supported by unions like SEIU, Unite Here, and UFCW, are pushing for higher wages and the right to form unions in cities from New York City and Chicago to Seattle. Striking banana workers are awaiting word from Del Monte on reinstating 59 fired workers. Jesse Russell reports.
Today is the ninth day of a strike by more than 650 banana workers in Costa Rica. The workers walked off the job due to Banana Development Company, a Del Monte subsidiary, firing 59 workers. Those workers were part of a strike in 2011, which resulted in the company negotiating a contract that included provisions saying it would not retaliate against workers who took part in strike actions. A judge has since ruled that 2011 strike illegal. Due to the current strike, three banana plantations are currently paralyzed, and the workers are calling on other plantations to join their protest. The workers have also taken to the streets, disrupting traffic on Thursday and Friday of last week. Del Monte is currently in negotiations regarding the worker demands to have the fired employees reinstated, but to date, the company has publicly reaffirmed it stands by its decision.
Workers Independent News is underwritten in part by the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and the OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. We're here in Las Vegas, Nevada, the People's Tour for America. If you want to follow where we've been, where we're going, PeoplesTourForAmerica.com. You can also check out our Facebook page, like us there, follow us on Twitter, all of that. Email us, Rick@therickSmithShow.com. We are here, like I said, Las Vegas. What a hot place. I don't know how you exist here.
Denise. Denise would get me through.
Would you?
Living, yeah.
It would be the coffee.
Hello. Hi, this is day 12 or something. We've gone to all these labor places. First person to give me coffee. Now my favorite human being.
There you go. Well, that's terrific.
Thank you, Denise.
So we've been highlighting what it is that AFSCME does here in the state and really in our state as well and across the country, representing not only all of us, But sadly, you know, not even themselves some of the times, as we found out in the last interview. Mm-hmm. You know, willing to advocate for others, but not so much for themselves.
Right. And, well, part of the story that we were learning is that the state workers can't tell the other state workers about the union. What is up with that?
No. Welcome to the law. That's what happens when the Corbetts of the world win. We're sitting here with one of AFSCME 4041 locals, one of their rock stars, Jennifer Knight, one of the local rock stars. Jennifer, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi.
That's it?
I don't know. I don't have a guitar riff to insert. You said I'm a rock star, well, and here I am with air guitar. Doesn't work on the radio.
You are rock star. You are the one to talk to.
Maybe. I know where to get some good food. It also depends on what questions you want, too. So,
okay, so first of all, don't tell him where good food is. He won't eat it, A. B, we will. Brett and I will be on it, but not him. You are the person who, when given an action, jumps. We need a letter to the editor. You write the letter to the editor. That is what makes you a rock star, is the fact that you're not sitting there thinking, I'm doing my part. Well, and this is a lot. If you are doing your part by being there, by attending meetings, you are doing a lot. Because we've been to places in the country now that have said they can't even get a quorum. They can't even get enough people to go to the meetings to get a quorum. So going to the meetings is important. But grabbing the bull by the horns and running, that is really important. And we've heard that's what you do.
Well, yeah, it's really important. I think it's important because I've learned in the various life experiences I've had that have put me to this point, there are some people who have a story that they can tell. Some people who are too, their story just gets caught in their throat when they try to tell it. And everyone actually does have a story if you just sit down and listen to them. And every story is usually worth listening to. Sometimes maybe it's only worth the free drink and the cover, but usually they're worth it. And one thing I found was when working through this legislative session, hearing all of the stories from everyone else. And I'd already seen so many of my coworkers in situations that had me moved to tears. I've been blessed because my boyfriend's pay raises have almost dollar for dollar offset my pay cuts. So I haven't been as dramatically affected, but I've seen everyone else hurt. I've seen everyone else get hungry. I've been the magic food fairy who brings the baskets of food to work. And finally, I just said, we've got to make this right, because I can't believe that our elected representatives are actually inherently evil. Maybe inherently naive, maybe a lot of them maybe stupid, but I don't believe that they're actually evil. I think they're actually just people who don't know. And so, bless Denise. She helped coordinate some training for op-ed writing and letters to the editor. And that, with listening to all of my brothers and sisters' stories, it inspired me. So I wrote an op-ed, and it was picked up by two of the larger papers here in the state. None of the papers in Vegas were brave enough, but it's okay. Elko and Reno got it. And the feedback from people on there was really supportive. And
so you didn't get any you're the greedy, evil state workers who destroyed
our economy? There was some feedback
that
was negative, but actually it was kind of surprising. If you followed the comment thread on Elko, you would see that there would people who'd be like, oh, being all greedy and we should get what we deserve, that's horrible. And then people would pipe in and say, no, I make less than $500 every 2 weeks. That's not enough to live on because of how much my premiums have gone up and how much they're taking out. And then when people started throwing out their actual earnings, the people who started being, oh, no, greedy public workers, it's like, oh, wait, our teat ran dry. And so it was something that moved me, and I think I've got a really weird, unique perspective that helps me with my energy. I remember as a girl going to IOTC's elections, and
okay, this is a nationwide hang.
Union. I'm the daughter of a union member who's the son of a union member. I'm third generation.
If I can cut this off for a second. This is what we were talking about earlier, that it's the union members who were willing to stand at the front it's their children who are willing to stand at the front as well. And why I do believe the right and the wealth class feel that they need to destroy unions as a whole, because this is what generations of unions, this is what is produced.
Well, it's not just that, but I think also one thing that's made me sad is I've realized that labor and women even fell asleep at the wheel. We kind of got tired. And because I remember also as a girl going with my mom to Planned Parenthood because insurance didn't cover birth control. So that was where she had to go. And I'm not that old. I'm not even 30 yet. And
I'm just going to do what I do all the time, which is stick up for both labor and women right now and say, being treated fairly shouldn't be something you have to fight for every day of your life. So they didn't get lazy. They maybe thought, I should have this, and I should. So, yeah, I know. And I know you didn't mean it that way, but I
got a better metaphor for it. I think what happened was everyone got really excited. They got this really big, fancy house. They finally qualified for it. And then they didn't stop and think, oh, I need to call the AC tech in. Oh, I should probably have the plumber come out and work on this. Oh, what do you mean I have to clean the coils under my fridge? You wouldn't get a big fancy house and put that investment into it of time, energy, and money, and then just let it get overrun with weeds and squatters and have someone peeing on your porch. That's what happened. We got a really good house with a great foundation, and then we let the squatters come in and start peeing on our porch. We need to get the squatters out. We need to paint the walls, scrub off the piss. We need to get this back in order and defend it.
So are you saying that the other people who get to share your benefits are those people that are squatting in the house?
I think they're people who don't understand the impact. I think that the squatters are some of the free riders.
The free riders.
I think, well, free rider. Well, I don't really think that, I don't know.
You don't think that maybe the corporate owners of the businesses came in and threw urine all over the floors, all over the walls, and then blamed the squatters?
I think what happened was people weren't protecting the image and the public perception. And with that tarnished public perception, it's hard to stay right. And that's why when I'm trying to organize, when I'm trying to recruit new members, I point out, hey, we need you. You can be a passive member and just contribute your dues if that's all you want to do, is just fill out a member card and say, yay, I've got access. Help us pay for our Denise. Help us have access. Help us have people who are giving us the tools and the framework that we need, because without that op-ed training, I never would have had that op-ed published. And I would have just been standing on Las Vegas Boulevard with a sandwich board holding up a sign that said, we'll process claims for food. I wouldn't have been able to get it out there to the rest of the state that our first-year welfare workers qualify for food stamps if they're the sole support for a household of two. I wouldn't have been able to get it out there to the rest of the state that our corrections officers are getting below subsistence wages. And I don't think it's right when we have people who are told, you have to keep society safe from these inmates in this prison population, but yet your take-home pay is going to be less than that of a fast food supervisor. It just doesn't seem right in my head, but there's so much bad connotation that has to be fought through that it's about being very careful with how it's said.
When you wrote your op-ed, did you picture who was going to read it? And did you think, if I could just get the fast food supervisor to understand that they need the union too? I mean, I agree with you. It's incredibly important that the image is protected, because tarnishing the image is what made people bash unions. But is there a point where you think maybe your next op-ed piece, you say, hey, by the way, 7 1/4, you know you're not living on it, you know you're working when you're sick, and you're blowing your nose on someone's cheeseburger? Let's all work together. Is there a point where that's the next piece you write?
Well, it's about steps, and it's about progression. And, yes, I firmly believe that our minimum wage is not a living wage. It's nowhere near. You could even, I mean, there's just so much wrong with knowing how many hungry people there are, knowing that a quarter of our country is food insecure, and yet you've got all these people working full time, yet still hungry, yet still getting their lights shut off. And that, it's about getting the momentum and keeping the momentum and not losing it, and making sure that when it's written to that audience, knowing, because I have a family with everyone from the labor union, yes, all the way to very, very, very deep red Republican. And so I have practiced speaking with everyone. And somehow no one's killed me yet or chased me with pitchforks or torches. So I seem to have something there. And it's just a matter of being able to point out to people this is wrong, and then help them recognize that it needs to be made right. Because I don't think people are angry enough with the minimum wage. I don't think people understand enough that there's enough wrong with the minimum wage. I don't think people understand even that there's problems with the wage inequality, that there is still a gender gap. And there's a lot of misinformation out there saying, oh, it's because women stay home. Okay, well, Dad, why don't you stay home when the kids got boogers? Your turn. But it's so tenuous right now because everything's become so violently polarized in some ways. I mean, when I was younger and I was careless and stupid, I had a bumper sticker that said, lobotomies for Republicans, it's the law, because it made me giggle. I almost got ran off the road during an election season. I'm like, wow, that's really going to make me want to vote for your candidate. But it's not the kind of environment you want to go out there and start spewing vitriol, because when you start getting vitriolic, people turn off.
That's not a law. Never mind.
I was going there with you, but...
Yeah. I thought maybe they'd already gotten them.
Yeah.
Already gotten what?
The lobotomy.
Oh, no. No. No, unfortunately.
You know, you touched on something that's really important. And Rick and I have been trying for, how long have we been doing this? About 17 years right now. Or 12 days. It's
somewhere in that range.
How do we have, and I got to get a copy of this op-ed you wrote, how do we have this conversation with people who right now are being taught to hate each other? What's your quote? The half of the people that get...
Well, Jay Gould, I could easily pay half the country, the working class, to kill the other half.
Get the right messengers. I have been the one to successfully insert into very heated conversations and bring them back. You need to get messengers who can successfully offer information, because the only way to successfully combat speech is with the right speech, not with noisy speech, but give people facts and show them data that actually can be meaningful. Colorful graphs are amazing.
Yeah, but what if you're talking with someone who doesn't believe your facts or your data or your information? Because, you know, I've got some very conservative friends who are vehemently anti-union, and you know, we argue all the time and we talk all the time. And you know, like you said, they're a quarter of the mm-hmm. population food insecure. I use the word hungry. You've got a quarter of the children collecting food stamps in the country, and we know the numbers. They don't believe them because they don't see it in their lives. They don't see it in their little corner of the world.
The way to make them see it is to make it real to them. Find a way to make it real to them, and then they will realize, oh, it may not be directly in their corner of the world, but they may not realize that, oh, my granddaughter's best friend at school, her mom works two jobs and can't even afford groceries after the rent's paid for. But these are stories people are too embarrassed and ashamed to talk about. So you don't know that your neighbor's hungry. You don't know that your coworker's hungry. And so what we need to do is we need to get people, we need to find the stories. We need to find the people who will tell the stories for those who just can't on their own. And we need to encourage those who have the story to tell their own story, if it's a compelling one. I mean, I wrote a great op-ed, but my coworker who was able to look the legislature in the eye and say, "You made me homeless 3 times, and I have to choose which one of my disabled children gets to go to the doctor when they're sick," that was the story that needed to be told. And having her directly tell it, I think went a lot farther than my op-ed could have, because they're the ones who actually cast the votes, and it was her story to tell.
But you're getting your, I don't know when the story was told, but you've gotten your pay cut, you've lost your benefits, you're getting furloughed. That story was told. I gotta tell you, I'll tell you about this guy, right? He's this guy. Some people know who he is, some people might not. They were asked him about the NFL. He said, "Oh yeah, some of my friends own those teams." He went to a NASCAR race and he went up to people who had purchased plastic things because it was raining, plastic punch, and said, "Hey, you really broke the bank buying that jacket, didn't you?" This is a man who, after traveling the country running for president of the United States, should have been exposed at some point to the fact that the crap is coming out his ears. And yet he still lives in denial. So these are the elected officials that you're talking about. How do you, in my opinion, waste no more time on them. Get rid of them.
To the fives.
Get rid of them. How do we get rid of them? Now, certainly we, Mitt Romney had his hat handed to him. And considering President Obama betrayed the 20% on his left and still won, that's how bad Mitt Romney lost. President Obama didn't win. Mitt Romney lost, and he lost big. And so, to me, and I'm not saying that, I don't want to dash your ardor of convincing these people to be human, but I just don't see it happening. And I want to know, how do we get more members of the Nevada state employees to become union workers? And then B, how do you replace these boobs?
It's Nevada.
Oh.
I could sing our state song.
Please.
Home means Nevada. Home means the hills. Home means the sage and the pines. It's not Nevada in the song, I promise. The Killers do it better. They're on YouTube singing it for Harry Reid. But it's not Nevada. Please, when you go back east, fix it.
I'll see what I can do, but I got to tell you, I'm still trying to get his kids to stop saying aunt, because I say aunt. So I'm kind of I'm Bostonian. Bad.
That's your fault.
It's okay. One thing I remember here, because having the unique position of a union without collective bargaining, we have collective begging. We have to lobby our legislature, who then gets to go behind closed doors with the governor. I got to meet a lot of these people. And I even got to meet some people who aren't exactly super friendly. And I got to realize, okay, what I need is for this human to see I'm human too. Insert yourself. And if the boob is still a boob, volunteer and get the boob out of office.
Get
the boots on the ground. I put in 120 hours to keep that boob out of office who has friends who own NFL teams. The NFL, one of the most socialist organizations out there.
Yeah.
And yet, unions are bad? Making sure everyone can eat is bad? No.
Did you see those big boys in their pads cry when their referees didn't come to work?
I would cry, too, considering some of the calls I was hearing about.
No, they were. But they were crying because they finally realized, hey, guess what? We didn't want to pay these guys, but son of a gun, they're important to us.
Well, I think it was mostly the owners, not the players, who were being the really douchey douchebags. But I don't know. I follow sports enough to know generally what's going on and whether I should cheer for the big ball or the oblong ball, and that's about it.
There you go. That's the way to do it.
If you could have the ear of every person in the country, and, Lord, I wish we could deliver it, what would you tell people?
It's not greedy to work and insist on receiving a living wage. It's not greedy to insist that I can make my ends meet and I don't have to worry about whether or not I have to have my power shut off if my brakes go out. It's not greedy, it's practical. It's not greedy to be appalled knowing that we have so many hungry kids in this country, and knowing that one in five kids, I mean, I am embarrassed to be a wealthy nation with so many hungry people. And when people were embarrassed about that in the 70s, hunger was fought and campaigned against, and it wasn't an embarrassment. There should be nothing embarrassing about having dignity and insisting on dignity. There should be nothing embarrassing about saying, I have a right to not be hungry. There should be nothing embarrassing about saying, I deserve a living wage if you're going to insist that I work for you full time, or if you're going to insist that I work part time whenever you want me to on such a horrible sporadic schedule with no guarantee that I can't get a second job so that I can try and make ends meet. The on-demand employment is hurting employers, because the problem with starving the employee in the consumer-driven economy is the consumers have nothing to drive anymore. And we've tried the sustaining on credit. It didn't work. There's no more demand. I mean, Henry Ford knew you pay your worker enough to buy the product you make. If you don't pay your worker enough to buy your own product, then you're a laughingstock. And if you don't pay your worker enough to have a living wage, then you're going to have to waste money on turnover. Training people is expensive. Hiring unqualified people who are inept and rude, it's expensive, especially in a customer service-based economy, which ours is shifting toward. People have to deal with people. And you're going to have bitter employees and hungry employees if you don't pay them a living wage and give them the respect that they've earned. It's not a handout. It's just giving someone what he's earned.
I'm right there with you. The other thing is, it's not greedy to want to be able to go to the doctor when you're sick. It's not greedy to have some dignity in retirement. It's not greedy. It should be something that's our right. And it's pretty much the bottom line. Jennifer, we appreciate you taking time for us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The People's Tour for America on the road. We're here in Las Vegas. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Pat LaMarche, and you're listening to an encore performance of the People's Tour for America. That's when Rick and the whole Rick Smith Show took off across the country to learn about labor history. Rick, what are you doing here?
I just popped in to see how the encore performances were going.
Go on vacation already. We'll be back after the new year with all new shows.
Weeknights, 9 to midnight, The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Never have so few done so little for so many. But at last, they're gone. Congress has adjourned for the year. And what a year it was. A few numbers sum up the sorry story, so let's review them. For example, 16. That's the number of days that a gaggle of Tea Party Republicans shut down our government by throwing an October hissy fit. Oh, add $24 billion to that. $24 billion is the economic loss America suffered from the Tea Partiers' shutdown stunt. Speaking of stunts, check out the number of times the House GOP has voted to make the political point that it doesn't want Obamacare to work. It now totals 47 times. Now here's a telling number, 239. That's how many paid days off our Congress critters gave themselves in 2013. Yes, for two-thirds of the year, they were no-shows at their ornate workplace. Hey, stuff like shutting down government and casting meaningless votes is tiring, and you've got to get your rest to keep up the pace. And here's a big angry number that our well-heeled lawmakers can't seem to see. 11 million. That's how many of our fellow Americans are jobless, some 4 million of whom have been out of work for more than 6 months. Yet, Congress went AWOL on its duty to respond to this raging job crisis. However, members did show up to slap America's hardest-hit workers. Just before taking off for their Christmas break, GOP lawmakers pushed a budget deal that killed an emergency benefit program for people who are mired in the misery of long-term unemployment. Yes, in the season of joy and goodwill, Congress, ho, 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 cut off this essential lifeline for 1.3 million workers and their families. Another 1.9 million will lose their benefits next year. This is Jim Hightower saying, but hey, who's counting? It's all just a bunch of numbers to Congress.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any of our coverage here in Las Vegas or any of the other places we've been, you can go to thericksmithshow.com or peoplestourforamerica.com. Find out where we've been, where we're going, who we've spoken to, pictures, lots of stuff there to see and do at the website. You know, one of the things that Jennifer said, Pat, that caught my attention, and I guess I do believe that some people are evil. You know, and I give her credit for having hope in humanity and hope in the people that I call the fives. But I guess I just don't have that kind of hope.
She's young. Hey, what's a five?
In organizing, it's 1 through 5.
Oh, the fives, the ones you'll never talk to.
The fives, you're never going to change the fives. Yeah. And you just walk on.
You know, and there are fives who are that way because they're stubborn or pig-headed or because, you know, they met somebody who looked like the guy who shot their dog, all right? But that's not who these evil people are. These evil people are the people who are, in any other situation, would be a sociopath. These are the people who would shoot your dog and then wear it, like Cruella de Vil.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying? No,
yeah.
It's true.
No, I hear you.
You know, and I think that, I mean, if we just live our lives through a Disney movie and forget the fact that Haitian children are making the big ears that you buy at the theme parks, it's the whole black and white nature of evil that is really missing people. And some days when I think about people who don't care how many people starve or are maimed for profit, like they were in Bangladesh, I have to remind myself that Auschwitz happened.
Yeah.
You know what? When you can't imagine evil, it's because you refuse to understand evil. You refuse to understand the potential it has. And so I love the fact that she's got a nice, sweet, open heart and acerbic wit. I wouldn't want to be on the wrong side of her tongue.
No.
But she's just sweet and young. And
but, you know, you look at this, and you know, because I do believe there is evil. I think taking food out of the mouths of children to give the multinational corporations, I think that's evil.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just ideological. I think it's downright evil.
Well, you don't care if a grandmother has the medicine she needs. If you don't care that there's any LIHEAP money so that the elderly and the disabled don't freeze to death in their homes. If you don't care about that stuff, take a look in the mirror, buddy. You're evil.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, at the end here, she said, you know, we're not greedy because we want to support our families. We're not greedy because we want to have a decent, secure retirement. We're not greedy. In fact, they don't even have a retirement. You know, and you look at this and you go, I agree with her. You're not greedy. You know, you're not greedy for saying we'd like to have health care.
No, and the thing is, if you're another average working stiff in this country, listen. Listen carefully, because you deserve those things too. Don't be feeling you know, put off because you don't have it and blame them because you don't have it. It's your employer's fault you don't have it. And think of your own kids. If you could really have a big meal just by starving your children, would you do it? Hey, you could have twice the helping if you didn't let little Billy eat. No. No, you say, look, little Billy gets his too. He gets his fair share. He gets to be healthy and strong. And I'll have a decent sized meal. I don't have to have the food for the whole family. That's all they're saying.
No.
If you work for someone who thinks their plate being full when yours is empty is cool, hey, you work for a bum.
But I'll tell you, in talking with Jennifer, to be honest, you know, she was, 30 almost?
Yeah.
You know, those are the kind of people that we need to stand up and say, enough already.
Well, I loved the people in Las Vegas, and I've loved all the people I've talked to, but really, I was so impressed with the people in Las Vegas that were able to string a certain amount of pride through every sentence they said. And, you know, these are the state workers. We've talked to all kinds of workers who work for private industry. And they all said the same thing. They take great pride in their work. They want to do a good job. They want to make sure that their employer gets, you know, their money's worth. That the job is well done. And I was really impressed with the way that they could articulate that and at the same time say, I'm also want to be darn sure that I go home at the end of the day and I can pay my electric bill. What was it Jennifer said? I loved it. That she didn't want to be afraid she couldn't pay her electric bill if her brakes went out.
Yeah.
You know, choosing between necessities is not, that's not the middle class.
But, you know, at the end of it, it comes down to that pride is because they have ownership. And I truly believe that when you have that kind of ownership, you take great pride in that, and you want to keep that. And that's what I took from that interview. I thought she was fantastic.
Me too.
Again, if you missed any portion of our coverage in Las Vegas or anywhere else across the country, peoplestourforamerica.com, that's where you go to find the audio, the podcast, the pictures, all of that stuff. We're going to take a quick break right back from the road. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hi, I'm Rick Smith.
And I'm Pat LaMarche.
Thanks for listening to this encore performance of our People's Tour for America.
Gee, Rick, just listening to the show makes me feel warmer.
Funny, Pat. I feel warmer, too.
Oh, Rick, you should feel warmer. You're in Florida right now on vacation with Carol and the kids.
That's right. But we'll be back after the new year with all new shows and some biting commentary for election year 2014.
I know I speak for everyone when I say I just can't wait.
The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Never have so few done so little for so many. But at last, they're gone. Congress has adjourned for the year. And what a year it was. A few numbers sum up the sorry story, so let's review them. For example, 16. That's the number of days that a gaggle of Tea Party Republicans shut down our government by throwing an October hissy fit. Oh, add $24 billion to that. $24 billion is the economic loss America suffered from the Tea Partiers' shutdown stunt. Speaking of stunts, check out the number of times the House GOP has voted to make the political point that it doesn't want Obamacare to work. It now totals 47 times. Now here's a telling number. 239. That's how many paid days off our Congress critters gave themselves in 2013. Yes, for two-thirds of the year, they were no-shows at their ornate workplace. Hey, stuff like shutting down government and casting meaningless votes is tiring, and you've got to get your rest to keep up the pace. And here's a big angry number that our well-heeled lawmakers can't seem to see. 11 million. That's how many of our fellow Americans are jobless. Some 4 million of whom have been out of work for more than 6 months. Yet, Congress went AWOL on its duty to respond to this raging job crisis. However, members did show up to slap America's hardest hit workers. Just before taking off for their Christmas break, GOP lawmakers pushed a budget deal that killed
people, you know, who have a history of it, know what it's like to sign the front of a paycheck, not the back of a paycheck.
If you're here to represent us, it comes to our pride. Say, say the USA.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. The People's Tour for America here in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Yeah, you guys sold it.
Yes, I did. I've got it. I think I got it right.
Yeah, but I'm going to say Nevada anyway.
I said I'm too.
Yeah.
I'm going to fall into that. That's just my problem. But I got to be honest, still hot.
It is really hot, no matter how you say the A.
I cannot imagine. You know, and look, we've been fortunate to be in air conditioning all day long, in and out a couple of times.
We were at the Hoover Dam. And there's a really weird sculpture there with the wings up in the air. And yep. I said, let's sit on the bench and do it. Didn't your butt cheeks burn?
Yeah,
my butt cheeks were burning.
That's why I didn't sit down. I knew that was going to happen.
You didn't sit down?
No, I stood behind you.
Oh, you stood behind us, yeah.
I got the picture to prove it.
Butt cheeks burning. And imagine if you had to sleep on that.
I
your
can't
whole,
imagine.
Everything, your hair, your face, everything.
Well, when we got here to Vegas, I dropped my cell phone. I reached down with one hand to kind of do a half push-up to reach under the car. Actually burnt my hand.
You did one-handed push-ups?
Yeah. Yeah, figure that one, fat guy. There you go. Nice. Thanks for that. Thanks for that. My sidekick, my support, yes. Thank you for that. Let's talk to somebody who's actually decent. We've got Grace Salazar sitting here with us. She's an AFSCME board member, AFSCME 4041, here in Las Vegas, Nevada. She's also a state worker. She works with the homeless, and I got to be honest, you know, I can't imagine, Grace, what it must be like for someone to be homeless in this city and in this god-awful heat.
And, Grace, you're going to have to come close to me. I promise I try not to smell too bad.
I think people, they know what to do. I mean, they're street smart. They know where to go when it gets hot, what to do when it gets hot. And you know, they know, and there's some agencies that they might be able to go to.
So let's talk about
they
what you
can
do.
Get out of the sun.
What's your title here? You work for the state?
I work for the state, and I'm a employment representative.
So you're the person who brought down the economy, who destroyed the nation. You state workers with your greed and your pensions.
Oh, that's not true at all. If people only knew what we did, if people only knew how much we help the public, how much we love our jobs. I happen to like what I do. I happen to like my job. So, you know, it's not that way at all. I wish the public would understand how much we help people get, like, I work with the homeless. We try to get them jobs. We try to get them back on their feet. We try to help them to appreciate what they have. As far as getting off the street,
you know, I completely understand. And of course, Rick's teasing. You know, he knows that you didn't crash the economy, and he knows that without you, that an awful lot of people who are already suffering would just suffer a little bit more. Yeah. And but the problem is, we're traveling this country doing 7,800. By the way, who said that? 7,800 in our dreams. We've already done 4,000 or
yeah,
something.
Well,
so
that was before we added Portland.
Oh, my gosh. So anyway, we're doing this huge road trip to try and let people know exactly what you said, that state workers are here to serve the public. They're not bureaucrats. They're public servants. They're people who give a damn about their community, give a damn about their families, and your family, too, and people who really make the operation of a society go more smoothly. So how do we get people to understand that? Because that's why we're doing this, to get people to understand it. And we're hoping that people who are actually out there doing the job, doing these public service jobs, can tell us what message they want sent to the average person.
Gina, I was at a function Saturday, and a lady came up to me and she says, do you know, I really don't understand. I really didn't understand, and I didn't know what state employees did and how much – of their benefits were taken away. And now I have a more appreciate you more and other state employees and what you're doing. So I want to thank you. So
part of the genius of our current system is you guys might make a few bucks an hour and you might have a couple of benefits. And as long as there are 50 million people in this country making minimum wage, they're going to think you're rich. And so they're able to pit those minimum wage workers against you instead of who they really ought to be against. I love it when you say it, the Wall Street crooks. You know, the people who really are taking corporate welfare and running off with, you know, with the country and getting us in wars and things. So somehow the average person is pitted against you because there's a $10 difference in your pay, in your hourly pay. And how do we get that person to say, no, you know, it's not the state worker that's your problem. It's the fact that you don't give the state worker an opportunity to go out to dinner with you after work and teach you how to organize your workplace.
And the other part of this is the state workers don't have Wall Street and these big PR firms who spend millions of dollars shaping message and advertising for themselves.
And not getting taxed and not paying their share of the money. But this is a right to work state. And another thing about that is that I don't understand how people could have voted that in. I just don't understand. I get calls all the time about they fired me and they won't tell me why, because an employer can hire and fire whoever he wants and he doesn't have to tell them why. So they call me and they say, well, they fired me. I've been loyal for 15 years, and they just let me go and didn't tell me why. And I said, well, are you a union member? No. Well, then an employer can fire you whenever he wants to. So it happens all the time.
The people don't think that it's going to happen to them?
Well, I think that's a big part of it. But the other part of it is, we think that we can make our own deals. And as I tell people, you know, that contract is so important. You show me one CEO in this country that doesn't have a contract. Show me one. There aren't them. They've all got there. And I look at Robert Nardelli when Home Depot fired him a number of years back, before he got the gig at Chrysler paying millions of dollars. When they fired him, they had to pay him $210 million. I've never gotten fired and gotten money when I left. I got fired and they said, and a couple of times, well, I did get something. The door hit me on the backside as I was going out. But I never got a check to leave. And it shows back to the whole contract thing. He had a contract. It laid things out black and white with each side. And I say no worker should be without one.
Yeah, but see, the other side of that also is that, yeah, that's what happens to them. The door hits them in the butt when they're told, you know, when they're told to leave. And the thing about it is they don't have the benefits. It's, you know, it's the working conditions. You know, the insurance, low wages,
The whole rule of organizing, wages, right? Hours, conditions. Those are the three
conditions. They're working in terrible, terrible conditions. And some of them might be, you know, some of them might not have papers, you know, and they're afraid to report. And that's who I try to help out sometimes, is to call, because it's not fair. It's not fair. So,
well, who does the average taxpayer think that the homeless veteran is going to turn to if you're not there?
That's the appropriate
response. You know, that's part of our job that we do. We try to help my priority is helping the veteran first, because they did so much for our country, and we have to give them all the help that we can. So that's my first priority, is to get them off the street. I mean, isn't it sad to see our homeless veterans, that our veterans that are coming home with no limbs, nothing, and we have to try everything to help these veterans.
And maybe even not letting them get broken in the first place.
Yeah. Well, the largest growing subset of homeless people right now is female veterans with children. That's the most rapidly growing subset of homelessness. Yes. Congratulations, United States of America.
That's absolutely true.
So in your work, as you deal with folks who are homeless, you know, what are you seeing? Are you seeing families? Are you seeing mostly men? Or is it a cross-section, a mix of, it just doesn't matter, white, black, it's across all
I'm lines. Seeing everything. You know, I'm seeing everything. It's all...
How about labor union members? Any homeless labor union members?
I've seen a few, yes, that have been let go, yeah.
Let go.
That because of the budget.
But they're not working in the job anymore. I have never seen a union member that has had
cashing
such
a paycheck.
Yeah.
Who's homeless. I haven't seen it.
Let go, sure.
Yeah. And it comes back down to the budget.
It happens to all of us. I mean, we have people right now that, you know, this is what helped us get a little bit of money, just a little bit. For 6 years, we've been without our benefits and barely making it. You know, we have people that really, sincerely, are getting food stamps and they're state employees.
See, this is where Corbett wants to take us. This is where our governor, Tom Corbett, and the budget fights that are going on right now, this is where he wants to take the state of Pennsylvania.
And it's the Alec game plan.
Absolutely.
That's where Scott wants to take Florida. That's where Walker wants to take Wisconsin. That's where LePage wants to take Maine. This is the game plan. They've been schooled and educated, and they're supposed to be doing it. And these guys aren't independent thinkers. And you know what really drives me crazy about them? They wouldn't be welcome. The Koch brothers wouldn't let them in the back door. But they wouldn't. They laugh at them. They laugh at them. They say, "Ha ha! Did you see what Corbett did for us in Pennsylvania?" And then they give them a quick call, get what they want, and then they laugh at them at their fancy caviar parties.
And you know the thing is, you look at all of these massive cuts, and as you pointed out, it is the Alec model. Now, let me ask you, Nevada, I'm sure, is no different than Pennsylvania or anywhere else. The massive budget cuts that have gone on, who have they disproportionately harmed? Is it the homeless that you deal with, or is it the people who own the casinos?
Probably the homeless. they're not getting all the services that they should be getting because a lot of people have been laid off or let go.
And have lost their home. I mean, Nevada
lost
is one of the
homes,
states
everything.
Still
everything.
Underwater.
And you know what? It happens to everybody. You can be anyone, a state employee, whatever. If you can't make it, if you get sick and you don't have a paycheck coming in, guess what? You're going to be out there too.
And that's the perfect point to make because, you know, I say this to a lot of my friends. We're doing well now. We're fine. We'll be fine. It could happen to any one of us
anyone,
at any minute.
Anyone. And that's the kind of people I get sometimes, that they lost their home or the husband got sick and they have, you know, children and they can't take them to the nursery because it costs too much. And guess what? They end up being homeless, walking down the street with what they have.
And what does that say about us as a society, as a whole? And you look at the last couple of years in Pennsylvania with the governor's cuts, and I'm sure Nevada's no different. Who was disproportionately harmed? Those who had the least amount of voice.
And the people with a voice who forgot they had it, the middle class.
Well, do you know what? There's a lot of state employees are having caseload after caseload. And how's that helping people? You know, we're not giving the service that we should be giving to them. After all, they are taxpayers.
After all, they are taxpayers. By the way, homeless people pay taxes. And every time they're treated like they don't, then just follow them to
they're the 47%.
Yeah. Thank you, Mitt. Mittens, how's the dog on the roof of the car? Wouldn't you like
ruining
to be driving?
My windows.
Yeah, wouldn't you love to be driving with a dog on the roof of your car in this weather? I'm telling you, really, honestly, I don't know how y'all do it.
I wouldn't even put mittens on the roof in the dog kennel driving through the. You can give me the face. I'm not even that.
Good for you. I might. I think of myself as a nice person, but maybe a mile.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, I think that it would be, I think it would behoove all of our elected officials to spend 2 weeks in your office with you and on the roof with the guy who put the roofs on and with the electrician. You know,
see, my only problem with that is because I've done the welfare food challenge and other people.
Yeah, but you don't need it.
I don't, and that's the point. I mean, so you say, well, these officials should be doing this stuff. At the end of the road, they still know. At the end of this week or two or month, I'm going back. The folks who are homeless, the people who need food stamps, the people who are struggling, there's no end of the month where I'm going back to
I know,
happiness.
I know, but the thing is that when you do something like that, it doesn't change your mind because you don't need your mind changed.
No.
If you put somebody in that situation who really believes those people are different from them and let them spend 2 weeks seeing that they might be different because they might just be better, but that's about the only difference you're going to get. Is that person who's putting their child ahead of them, Gainesville, Florida, where they had maximum feeding limits, and you could only feed 122 people, and a woman showed up at 121, 122, and 123, and one of them could not be fed. So she sent her children in, and she went hungry. Those are the homeless.
Yeah.
And these people, if they met them, they might. But unfortunately, it's people like you who don't need it that do it, and not the people who really do.
Well, I think if they really did that, they would learn a lot, but I feel like they would say, "Whoa, wow! I've seen enough," and run down the street.
That's a sad testament and a sad reality.
Really,
which is why I think it's so incredible that there are folks like you who do the jobs that you do that are so vital to our community. Because I think, as you said earlier, it could be me tomorrow. I don't know what happens to me and my children, and Would we be the ones? Absolutely. The kids are going to eat first. Sad reality is we don't see that stuff in the news. No. We only see the negative stuff.
But when we can bring this up, how about senior citizens? I have older senior citizens, little old ladies, little old men, that are out there pushing a cart. Now that is so out of control.
I agree.
Like the veterans. But to see our elderly out there that have worked all their life and to be out there, that is so, I can't imagine that we're letting this happen.
Right.
The country's given up shame for bravado. We're the best! American exceptionalism.
I'm number one.
It stops us from saying, you know what? We are a darn fine country, and we could be that much better.
With you. It's the last line of question I've got for you. You look at all the things that have gone on and all the things that you've seen in your career. What should we be doing? If you had the chance, what would we be doing for the workers in your department, for the citizens of this of Las Vegas and the homeless folks who desperately need the help?
I think that we should hire more people to help out so that we can give the service that the public deserves. I think that social services should, they cut a lot, and they cut a lot of their people also. And people should be aware. And I hope that by doing this interviews that you're doing, you're helping them to understand what state employees do. And they'll have a better understanding and do something about it.
I'll tell you, we talked before the interview a little bit, and I don't know how you do what you do. And, Pat, I don't know how you, the director of Safe Harbor and all the homeless work you've done over the years, I don't know how you do it. I would be distraught daily, I think.
It's a very rewarding job. I love it. It's rewarding knowing that you're helping these people. And giving them a pat in the back when they get a job because they're overcome with that. They haven't had a job in a long time. And it's rewarding, very rewarding job. And I just have one more thing to say, that I was born here in Las Vegas, and when I was in my mother's womb, of course, I was a Democrat. And when I was born, the first thing I uttered was to my mother, a Democrat, and the second, I said mom, and then the second thing I said to my father was union.
Nice.
Your parents raised you right.
So, as we've been saying, it comes back to first line in the home.
Yeah.
And then in the society and in schools, and you obviously got it from the home.
I come from a long line of union people, so, yeah.
You're wonderful. Your parents, your parents did a good job on you in more than way, more ways than one.
We need more Grace Salazar.
Thank you.
Grace, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much for doing this. Thank you. We appreciate it.
The People's Tour for America here in Las Vegas, Nevada. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
That's all you are to me.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
I'm Pat LaMarche, and you're listening to an encore performance of the People's Tour for America. That's when Rick and I and the whole Rick Smith Show took off across the country to learn about labor history. Rick, what are you doing here?
I just popped in to see how the encore performances were going.
Go on vacation already. We'll be back after the new year with all new shows.
Weeknights, 9 to midnight, The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
As the U.S. Senate struggles to pass immigration reform in a form that will also pass the House, the AFL-CIO is reminding lawmakers that Americans in all but paper deserve a path to citizenship. The Labor Federation says immigrants should not be forced to run an obstacle course. The AFL-CIO says it opposes any amendments to the bill that, quote, impose hard triggers whose real purpose and real impact will be to close off the opportunity for eligible immigrants to become citizens, end quote. Meanwhile, SEIU Secretary Treasurer Eliseo Medina says a CBO score on the immigration reform bill shows it's good for the U.S. economy by reducing the deficit and increasing the gross domestic product. A 17-day, 15-city, coast-to-coast Summer of Solidarity tour is planned for later this summer as local union activists and community allies support local struggles, connecting them with the broader fight against corporate power. United Steelworker Union locals and the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America will kick off that tour August 17th in Philadelphia, wrapping it up on Labor Day in Los Angeles. More information at summerofsolidarity.org. As the Netroots Nation Conference kicks off in San Jose, members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus will join workers to launch a Raise Up America campaign in support of the low-wage worker movement. It's aimed at raising pay for American workers to get the economy moving again for everyone. Low-wage workers, supported by unions like SEIU, Unite Here, and UFCW, are pushing for higher wages and the right to form unions in cities from New York City and Chicago to Seattle. Striking banana workers are awaiting word from Del Monte on reinstating 59 fired workers. Jesse Russell reports.
Today is the ninth day of a strike by more than 650 banana workers in Costa Rica. The workers walked off the job due to Banana Development Company, a Del Monte subsidiary, firing 59 workers. Those workers were part of a strike in 2011, which resulted in the company negotiating a contract that included provisions saying it would not retaliate against workers who took part in strike actions. A judge has since ruled that 2011 strike illegal. Due to the current strike, three banana plantations are currently paralyzed, and the workers are calling on other plantations to join their protest. The workers have also taken to the streets, disrupting traffic on Thursday and Friday of last week. Del Monte is currently in negotiations regarding the worker demands to have the fired employees reinstated, but to date, the company has publicly reaffirmed it stands by its decision.
Workers Independent News is underwritten in part by the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and the OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
And I haven't got a penny, but I buy no more whiskey. I have to go home. Brother, my cup is empty, and I haven't got a penny.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, I got to tell you, Pat, I listened to Grace talk there, and I don't know that I could do that kind of work. I don't know that I could every day fight those battles and see that kind of desperation and that kind of despair. I just don't know that I could.
I think you know, I don't just think you could. I think you'd be great at it. And I think you'd love it, but even if you wouldn't love it, I'd love to see you do it for like 6 months. Just because when you do that job, when you work with people who are weak and frightened and humiliated, they need strength, and they borrow people's strength. And you're such a strong person that you would really make people feel protected. And then they feel more powerful when they go out into the world and they have to tell their employer that they've lost their home, or they have to deal with their kids. They really borrow strength from the people around them. And I would love to see someone as strong as you, you know, spending a day talking to five or six people who the wind has just been robbed from their sails by their reality. And I can just see a lot of men that I've seen that have become homeless in my time working in the homeless shelters. I can see them really being able to talk to you much better than to a woman. That, you know, they're already humiliated to their own wives, and they shouldn't be. It's not justifiable or fair, but, you know, I can see a guy coming up to you, like the guy that came into Safe Harbor one time, who had lost his job at Maslin. Maslin shut down. He had colon cancer, and he had a disabled child.
Jeez.
And he was looking for a shelter, not only that would take a man, but he was looking for a shelter that would handle his child's wheelchair.
I don't even know. See, I got to be honest. Yeah, my mentality, the way I'm a fixer. I got to be able to fix things. And my fear in that is there is so much outside your control and so much that you would want to do that I don't know that I could. And I think that would tear me apart. I mean, yeah. I look at that situation and I personally, I would just be destroyed.
Yeah, I don't think you would. I think you would. I mean, can you imagine making that man feel like he can go through another day? You know, what a difference you'd make for that man's life, and that's what I think would happen. And you know, we may never know.
Yeah.
You may never know if you're going to give that kind of thing a shot. And we can't all do every job, and the job you're doing is really important. You know, if 10 extra people change their mind over the course of this month because of this tour that you're doing, if 10 extra people stop looking down their nose at that guy with cancer who lost his job and realize that's what a homeless person is, you know, if 10 extra people stop ridiculing people just because they want a decent wage, well, then, you know, you can't leave this kind of job to go do that one. You're in the right place.
The other thing that caught my attention, she said that the Key Foundation had a group that she said was a non-profit. I have no reason to not believe her.
It is a not-for-profit. It's a foundation. It's a not-for-profit. That's the point where for-profit industry like Key Bank, and it was Key Bank, gets to have a not-for-profit and then gets to infiltrate government offices, and bada-bing, bada-bang, guess who just got privatized?
Because I was going to ask you about that, because is it... You think that's the goal there?
Well, I've been talking to some of my buddies in the homeless industry in the last, you know, several hours since that interview. So I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. Has anybody heard about this Key Foundation? I looked it up on the internet while we were talking to her. And sure enough, you know, this is just government letting private industry in under the guise of being a not-for-profit. I mean, you could open a not-for-profit, Rick. You could make your radio show a not-for-profit. Well, kind of technically you have, but that's another story.
Yeah, that's a whole other story.
That wasn't on purpose. But you know, you could have your own not-for-profit and run all kinds of behavior through that. And as long as you kept true to your mission, and this was the whole, you know, the IRS scandal? This sort of application for not-for-profit by a huge banking industry like KeyBank. No fine-tooth comb, man. I want them running through that with a steamroller.
I'm with you.
You know? I mean, a huge banking industry getting into government offices to process claims for people who have, you know, taxpayer dollars that are going to be helping them out of poverty. Whoa, now that money gets filtered through there. Not for profit. You know what? If I don't smell a rat, I smell a very big mouse.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. But I enjoyed our conversation with her, and you know, I give her credit. You think I can? I don't know. I think it would just tear me up. But
I think somebody might get torn up.
That's my problem. That's the other part of it. I think I would. I'd probably strangle somebody. That wouldn't be helpful either.
Little Tommy, your school says you can't come to school today.
I say yes.
Well, Uncle Rick's walking you in this morning.
and that's, well, maybe that would help.
Yeah, who needs the McKinney-Vento Homeless Education Act when you got guns? Oh. And I don't mean the kind of that shoot. I mean the kind that hang off your biceps.
There you go. Yeah. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this from the road. We're in Las Vegas. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You know I told you once tonight that you could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
So Rick's off to Florida with his family. We'll be playing encore performances of the People's Tour right through the new year.
No, wait, I'm still here.
Rick, what are you doing here?
Well, Pat, I wanted to make sure that we were playing the People's Tour while I'm gone.
Rick, you and everyone else can rest assured that each night from 9 until midnight, we'll hear some of the very best interviews from our trip across the country, exploring labor history.
Right here, 9 to midnight, on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Never have so few done so little for so many. But at last, they're gone. Congress has adjourned for the year. And what a year it was. A few numbers sum up the sorry story, so let's review them. For example, 16. That's the number of days that a gaggle of Tea Party Republicans shut down our government by throwing an October hissy fit. Oh, add $24 billion to that. $24 billion is the economic loss America suffered from the Tea Partiers' shutdown stunt. Speaking of stunts, check out the number of times the House GOP has voted to make the political point that it doesn't want Obamacare to work. It now totals 47 times. Now here's a telling number, 239. That's how many paid days off our Congress critters gave themselves in 2013. Yes, for two-thirds of the year, they were no-shows at their ornate workplace. Hey, stuff like shutting down government and casting meaningless votes is tiring, and you've got to get your rest to keep up the pace. And here's a big angry number that our well-heeled lawmakers can't seem to see. 11 million. That's how many of our fellow Americans are jobless, some 4 million of whom have been out of work for more than 6 months. Yet, Congress went AWOL on its duty to respond to this raging job crisis. However, members did show up to slap America's hardest-hit workers. Just before taking off for their Christmas break, GOP lawmakers pushed a budget deal that killed an emergency benefit program for people who are mired in the misery of long-term unemployment. Yes, in the season of joy and goodwill, Congress, ho, 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 cut off this essential lifeline for 1.3 million workers and their families. Another 1.9 million will lose their benefits next year. This is Jim Hightower saying, but hey, who's counting? It's all just a bunch of numbers to Congress.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. The People's Tour for America, discovering, well, workers discovering their history as we move across the country. And, Pat, you know, as we've been here in Las Vegas talking to a number of AFSCME members and some of their leadership, you know, I go back and I look at how state workers in general are being attacked on every level. And it's, well, it's sickening on so many levels because the people we've met, good, honest, decent, hardworking people.
Yeah, and you know, when we were talking to the Teamsters and I found out they were Teamsters for trucking and Teamsters for trains, I thought, wow, two different things. AFSCME represents every kind of everything the state does. They represent the workers who do it. So they have to know the disciplines of everything. Yep. from social work to prisons.
And we've got a corrections person here with us, Gordon Milton, who works with the Nevada Department of Corrections. He's also recording secretary of the corrections chapter of AFSCME Local 4041. Gordon,
that's correct.
Thank you for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
In your capacity as someone who works in the Department of Correction, I can't imagine the state budget cuts have done very much to help you with your job.
No, it hasn't. I see what the staffing issues we have at where I work at. I work at High Desert State Prison. The staffing issues, it's pretty brutal. You get so many corrections officers trying to keep an eye on so many inmates. High Desert has about over 3,000 inmates there.
Wow.
And it's just trying. They can only do so much.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with the resources that you have, it's difficult to do everything that needs to be done. And, you know, in Pennsylvania, right before the Screwquester came into effect, there was a federal corrections officer up in the northern part of the state who was killed on the job because he was murdered because he was putting prisoners away by himself. Something that I'm told is not supposed to be the way it is. But when you talk about staffing levels and shortages, it's what you end up with. That's the reality.
And the reality is, you know, things have to get done. And, you know, just because you're understaffed doesn't mean that the work stops. And if the work stops, people, inmates, they're people too. You know, what about them? I'm not a corrections officer. I'm what they call free staff, which is like, you know, low man on totem pole there.
But you have an extremely, in my view, an extremely important job.
Well, yeah, I help inmates. I'm in the reentry program. I help inmates transition out into society.
I think that's the most important job, getting people from prison life back into normal society where they're going to be functioning. They've paid their debt to society. Now they're going to be functioning members of society.
And it's our jobs to help give them the tools available to them so that they can function in society. So whether they're going to a halfway house when they get out, you know, on probation, or whether they go to a private residence, you know, we're supposed to be there to help them transition there. That way they can have the tools available to them so that they can go out and get a job. They know how to, you know, fill out resumes. They know how to operate in society again, something that's not a structured environment which they have while in prison.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I do think, though, the fact that you're made to feel like you're the low man on the totem pole kind of proves the priority system, which is who really cares if these people survive on the outside because they're coming back. You know, it's kind of a game, set, match attitude. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the largest prison population in the world.
When it comes to, when it comes to the general public, it just appears, I'm not certain that this is the way it is, but it just appears to me that, you know, when it comes to prisoners and inmates, it's, you know, out of sight, out of mind. They'd rather, like, hey, okay, it's happening over there. It's not happening here. Great. Let them do their thing. You know, so long as we don't have to deal with them, that's fine. But unfortunately, or fortunately, it's the case, we look at it, there's always someone coming out of prison and they're being relocated into your neighborhood. Every zip code has inmates coming in to either go to a halfway house or go to a residence. And so these inmates, you know, there's someone's brothers, there's someone's father, there's, you know, these are people.
Yeah.
And these people do need to get on with their lives. They paid the debt to society, you know.
And that's the key right there. They've paid their debt to society. Now help them transition into civil life. And so let me ask you, you know, with that in mind, and it sounds like that's your view, do you think you get the resources to help you do your job? Do you think you're given the tools that you need to make sure that those folks don't come back? And I know nationwide the recidivism rates are through the roof because, in my view, I think it's because you're not getting the resources you need and they're not getting the transition help that they need to become productive members of society.
Well, just like everyone else in the Nevada Department of Corrections, we're doing the best we can with what we have. I would prefer to have more resources available to help these guys, especially when they're inside. Because once they're inside, they're there. They're not going anywhere. So it would be great if we could give them more tools while they're there and then help them not only when they're 3 to 6 months before they get out, but over the long term while they're there, you know, give them courses, you know, starting from when the intakes, right when they get there to you know, from as it were, cradle to grave, as it were, from start to finish.
Right.
But unfortunately, you know, I wish we had more.
Yeah. So let me ask you, you know, and when you talk to people and you tell folks what you do, do they appreciate the fact that, you know, the state does this? Because, you know, I don't know that they would think you're a state worker, because there's been an assault on state workers across the country, on public sector workers as a whole. Do people identify with what you do as a public sector job and one that I think is vital to our community? Do you think your friends and neighbors and family, do they get that?
It seems that the vast amount of people I talk to, they would prefer that these guys never come out at all whatsoever. And
wow.
I guess they kind of see me as helping release criminals onto the streets. My gosh, you know, what are you doing? You know, these guys are bad guys. They should be left inside. Well, some of them are bad guys, but some of them just made a mistake. And they're doing what they were told to do. They're supposed to be in prison 5 to 10 years. They are there. You know, a lot of these guys, they're just, you know, even when it comes to, if you hear stories where the prisoners always try to, attack a corrections officer, always try to kill them. No, these guys are there. They're just trying to do their time, and, you know, they don't want to cause any trouble. They just want to do the time so they can get out and get on with their lives.
Yeah.
It's just that, unfortunately, that people on the outside is like out of sight, out of mind, and they don't want them back in their lives anymore. And there are, you know, people on parole, you know, all around them all the time. They just don't know it. You know, they're like, you know, they're doing fast food jobs. They're doing, the mechanics. Every walk of life, there's a potentially, you know, ex-felon, you know, trying to do his thing and just trying to survive.
Now, you you work for the state prison, and I imagine you have county jails and possibly a federal prison in the state of Nevada. Are any of the other jails, would you know if any of the other jails are privatized?
At one time, the Florence McClure Women's Prison was at one time a privatized prison, but that, for some reason, it didn't work out that way, and it reverted back to state control. So there's a women's prison out right by outside on Las Vegas, right by the Air Force Base, and that's where the female inmates are held at. And it was privatized, but now it's part of the state again.
So another example of Nevada doing the opposite of what Corbett in Pennsylvania wants to do. They were privatized, things moving back towards state workers and state control. Our governor, let's privatize and profitize everything.
But there are certain aspects of the prison, the state prison system that the rumors and their actions of being privatized, such as I believe the medical workers, they want to privatize those. It's just, you know,
we're talking about the exact same thing.
Chipping away at the piece by piece. I would, oddly enough, I would prefer to see more state-run institutions as opposed to privatized institutions. It'll make my job a little easier if we had more places where the inmates can go to that are state-run, that's not a prison, such as halfway houses. There is a
alternative sentencing.
Yes, there's one, the traditional housing that is state control. That's Casa Grande off of Russell here. That's where inmates who were there.
The big house.
It's called Casa Grande. Yes, it is.
You can't make that up. Where are you going when you get out?
Going to the big house.
Yeah, when inmates are there, they're allowed to go out, get a job, and work outside, and then they have to report back after their day is. And so it's just relaxed. The inmates have a lot more free time. They can go in and out.
Right.
Now, that is a big problem. So you have mostly privatized halfway houses? Because I used to work at a homeless shelter, and we had this one particular murderer who was released, and she was sent to a privatized halfway house, and she was victimized at the halfway house and ended up in a homeless shelter. And, you know, you said someone next to you is on parole, you know, you go through your day and have someone next to you on parole. Hey, guess what? Someone next to you on parole could have been in prison for murder, right? I mean, you really want these people to be better, and you really want these people to be in good shape. You don't. And in this case, this woman's case, she was a teenage girl who killed the guy who killed her baby. She went to prison for 27 years.
I'm not surprised that happened. Unfortunately, she was, you know, victimized while she was in a halfway house. And supposedly, when it comes to Nevada, the halfway houses that are parole probation approved are go through a rigorous screening process before they're allowed to be on the PNP approved list. And they are mostly volunteer, religiously volunteer halfway houses. There's one up in the Reno area, which is, I guess they have federal funds coming to them, so it's a very popular one that everyone wants to go to. But the mostly ones in the southern Nevada area, which I'm familiar with, they're smaller ones. Some of them have 5-10 beds, and there's like just 3 or 4 of them in the southern Nevada area. And so when we have at least 3,000 plus southern desert, plus the everyone in southern Nevada is trying to go after 50 beds, there's a big long waiting list of people ahead of you before you actually get out.
So you can't get out of jail if you don't have somewhere to go?
Correct. If you're on parole.
So if there's nowhere to go, you never get out. That is a privatizer's dream.
If you're on parole, if you've been granted parole and you have no place to go, you stay there until you expire. So you may have been granted parole, but if you have no place to go, if you burn your bridges, your family won't take you, you have no friends, you cannot afford to pay the deposit to a halfway house.
You better never get thrown in jail in Nevada.
No, kidnapped. They say it wrong all the time. Okay, now, I'm not easily shocked. I just want you to know that. Although I try on a regular basis to shock myself. So you just shocked me. But then you said something else that got me even a little more, whatever the word would be. If you don't have the deposit for a halfway house, did he just say if you don't have the deposit? What are you doing? Like, how much do you pay guys for license plates?
Well, you can qualify for Richard funding, but it's a strict process. If you don't have the funds, if you don't have relatives who can help you with your deposit for a halfway house, if you've been
debtor's prison, anyone?
One or two times in prison, if you're first or second termer, you still can qualify for Indigent funding, so long as you have your Social Security card and birth certificate on file, so that when you get out, you can take those documents to the DMV, get an Nevada ID, get a job. So if you can qualify for that, the state will pay a deposit for you at a halfway house so that you'll have at least some time out there to go get a job and to continue to pay a deposit for a halfway house. These are privatized halfway houses that are, you know, run by churches, run by individuals who are trying to help, but they're privatized.
So,
but if you cannot afford it, you do not qualify for initial funding for whatever reason, you will stay in prison until you expire, in which case you'll get a $25 card, and you get dropped off, then that's it. You're on your own.
There's $25. There's the door.
There's $25. Now you're dead. You expired. You know, well, right?
You're dead? No, to your term's up.
Yeah, your term's up. You've done your time.
Not until you die.
I'm sorry.
They're waiting for him to die. I'm like, oh, my God. Okay, so till the expiration of your term. So you got 20 years. You got paroled at 13, but you have to stay for the 7 because you didn't have anywhere to go.
You got nowhere to go.
Okay. So now I'm getting a handle on your job. I'm all over it now. I watch genius here. These people need indigent funding if they don't have the money to go to one of 50 places that they might be able to go if they actually had somewhere to go when they got paroled. Right?
Correct.
Okay. So then you, who have the lowest job on the totem pole, have to help people who may no longer even have a clue what their Social Security number was because they were in prison for 10, 20, 15, 30 years. You've got to help them apply for this indigent funding and do all these other things so that hopefully they have a place to go so that they can get out, and your job is the lowest on the totem pole?
Sometimes that's how you feel.
That's how I feel. I've known you for 30 minutes.
Well, again,
I think you're fabulous.
Well, I think I'm fabulous, too. One must have a high sense of self-esteem. You gotta have a bright outlook on life. You got to think positive. And the idea is that you got to go in there with the attitude, hey, I'm cool. You know, And so if you don't have a positive attitude, you know, being in prison can be very depressing. So you got to make your own fun. You know, and that's why you socialize with the CEOs. You make friends with them because they're cool people. And they get shafted a lot. It's like...
Well, you know what? It rolls downhill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the CEOs, I think, are way, way, way underappreciated for what they do. Because they have to be part-time social workers, they have to be grief counselors, you know, they're the first line of contact between the institution and the inmates. You know, they have one, this was a caseworker assigned to every unit, and he's overseeing like 200 inmates, where the CEOs are out there amongst them. You know, they're not behind bars, they're walking with them, you know, as they're going from place to place, as they're going to their, for food, as they're going to classes, as they're going to outside to exercise, they're right there with them. And they're the ones who are, you know, getting grief from the inmates, saying, "Hey, I'm depressed. You know, I have no idea what to do. You know, I just got a letter from home, and my girlfriend's like, you know, cheating on me." And so these guys have to keep the peace. They're the ones who have to keep, you know,
or suffer the brunt of the consequence if they don't. Yeah. So let me ask you a last question I've got for you, Gordon. You know, in looking at this, you know. The more I learn about this, the more I go, this is a job. I don't want this. But, you know, the conditions have got to be such that you need representation. You need someone to have your back and stand up for you. And I guess that's why you're a member of AFSCME.
Yes. My thing is, as a state worker, we don't have collective bargaining, so there's really no one to fight out battles for us. And, you know, my thing is, I'm a big union believer. I believe, 40-hour work week, health and safety regulations at work, a lot of stuff was union born. And so I guess, maybe unions are being passé these days. You know, attitudes are like, unions are a big drain on society. No, I don't believe that. I believe that, there's a good place for union in this society,
So why'd you join?
Because I'm just a firm believer. My father, he was a union when he was with the state of Nevada. He retired from the Air Force, went to work for the state, union member. He did his things, and I hear stories from him saying, "Hey, this is what's happening at work, and this is what we're trying to do to fix it." And I got inspired by that. You know, I said, "Hey, if I ever decide to become a state employee, and as a junior, I'm joining because, again, I think they do good things. And, it's like you lead by example. If you get fellow employees that think, "I don't want to join," or anything that, you fight for, I guess. So, ha-ha. So,
freeloaders.
Yeah. We get some of that. And right now where I work at, it seems that people up the food chain are like constantly banging him down, hitting him with a mallet, and so after a while, you get depressed, you get the enthusiasm beaten out of you, and so what happens? What can I do? Well, I can go and do the graveyard shift. I get 5% more. I don't have to deal with management. I can do my thing, and it's safer that way. Well, what about the people, your fellow coworkers who are not on the graveyard shift, who do have to deal with management? Well, how can I sit back and let somebody else fight my battles for me? I can't do that.
And that's why we band together. Gordon, we appreciate the time. We appreciate your story. Thanks so much.
No problem, sir.
Gordon Milton, Nevada Department of Corrections. He's a recording secretary for the corrections chapter here at AFSCME Local 4041. We are in Las Vegas, Nevada. The People's Tour for America continues right back after these messages. Stick around.
Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class. Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
So Rick's off to Florida with his family. We'll be playing encore performances of the People's Tour right through the new year.
No, wait, I'm still here.
Rick, what are you doing here?
Well, Pat, I wanted to make sure that we were playing the People's Tour while I'm gone.
Rick, you and everyone else can rest assured that each night from 9 until midnight, we'll hear some of the very best interviews from our trip across the country, exploring labor history.
Right here, 9 to midnight on The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Never have so few done so little for so many. But at last, they're gone. Congress has adjourned for the year. And what a year it was. A few numbers sum up the sorry story, so let's review them. For example, 16. That's the number of days that a gaggle of Tea Party Republicans shut down our government by throwing an October hissy fit. Oh, add $24 billion to that. $24 billion is the economic loss America suffered from the Tea Partiers' shutdown stunt. Speaking of stunts, check out the number of times the House GOP has voted to make the political point that it doesn't want Obamacare to work. It now totals 47 times. Now here's a telling number, 239. That's how many paid days off our Congress critters gave themselves in 2013. Yes, for two-thirds of the year, they were no-shows at their ornate workplace. Hey, stuff like shutting down government and casting meaningless votes is tiring, and you've got to get your rest to keep up the pace. And here's a big angry number that our well-heeled lawmakers can't seem to see. 11 million. That's how many of our fellow Americans are jobless, some 4 million of whom have been out of work for more than 6 months. Yet, Congress went AWOL on its duty to respond to this raging job crisis. However, members did show up to slap America's hardest-hit workers. Just before taking off for their Christmas break, GOP lawmakers pushed a budget deal that killed an emergency benefit program for people who are mired in the misery of long-term unemployment. Yes, in the season of joy and goodwill, Congress, ho, 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 cut off this essential lifeline for 1.3 million workers and their families. Another 1.9 million will lose their benefits next year. This is Jim Hightower saying, but hey, who's counting? It's all just a bunch of numbers to Congress.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
The flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any of our coverage from Las Vegas, you can check out the podcast, PeoplesTourForAmerica.com, or therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can see pictures, all the things that we've done on the tour, where we've been, where we're going, there as well. You can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, all of that. Any questions, comments, thoughts, you can email me, Rick@therickSmithShow.com. So, Pat, as we wrap up our day here in Las Vegas, thoughts?
I love it here. I'm ashamed of the way I pronounce the state, which I'll never even say the word again. And would you not tell me if I smelled bad? I thought you would, but nobody wants to get very close to me when I'm holding this mic.
You're very intimidating holding that mic.
Am I?
Yes.
You should see me with a baseball bat.
All righty. Yeah. Well, we're sitting here with Mr. President, the president of Ask Me Local 4041, Lou Lombardo. Lou, I want to thank you personally for having us come into your hall and having us talk to some of your members. It's been a great day. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
So, you know, in looking at all of the assaults going on around the country against public sector workers, and in Nevada no different than any other state, how do you get your members motivated? How do you get some of the wonderful people we've talked to, Jennifer and Gordon and those folks, how do you keep them motivated?
Well, you've got to be able to relate to them. It's something we all share with each other, and that's a paycheck. You know, you all bring a paycheck home. And once you start seeing your benefits disappear, that should draw everybody together. So that kind of is a motivating factor, because I think people are moved into action when their stomach starts to growl.
Yep. You know? Well, I've always said, when your stomach's empty, your head gets right.
Your head gets right. That's right.
And, you know, as you look at this, and, you know, we've seen this concerted effort, this well-funded assault on people who do vital work for us. I mean, you know, people who work in the Department of Corrections, people who work in the Department of Aging, and all of the folks that we've talked to. As we see these attacks go on, how do we fight back? I mean, there's got to be more than what we're seeing in the mainstream corporate-controlled for-profit media.
Well, unity, is people have got to be able to unite and come together and put everything else aside and stand on common ground. There is common ground for all of us. Okay, so we got to be able to put those aside and come together for the common good.
You know, I love hearing that. And I love hearing it not following some pile of fear. Because it seems what's happening in the on the national scene and even the statewide scenes where the politicians get up and they speak about unity and the only thing they seem to be able to unite us behind is what we're afraid of.
Yep.
And that's really the difference with these unions. They're united for each other, to care about each other, to make each other's lives better.
And even non-members' lives better.
See, I see us living in a time, well, I'm no youngster, and I've been around. I'm 57 years old, so I remember the old school, the old days. I remember when people did get together and people, neighbors, talked to each other, and we had something that bonded us. And today it seems to be all different. You know, neighbor, you can live next to your neighbor, not even know you've been living there 10 years. You don't even know who he is.
Well, do you think that has a lot to do with, you know, maybe all those years ago you had more disposable time, you had more free time to join organizations? You know, today, as you look at the number of hours people work continually going up, the stresses of everyday life, just staying on that treadmill to keep going to the next day seems to be getting that much harder. So, I'm not answering for you, but could that be part of it?
That's part of it. People just came together. They cared. They cared about their neighbors, you know. They cared about their coworker. See, if my coworker is not doing well, it means I got to work twice as hard to make up the slack because he's not there because whatever reason, okay? Because he's sick, not getting good medical care. His health insurance is so expensive he can't afford to get to work. There's a lot of that going on. I mean, insurance has just gone sky high. I mean, it was worse than the pay cut. We had a pay cut of 2.5%, and then they increased our health insurance, which was unbelievable to me. It caught my attention, really caught my attention. It went up 130%.
Wow.
130%. It was worse. It was far worse than the pay cut and the furlough. We had the furlough to deal with. So because in this whole discussion with, you know, we don't have collective bargaining, but during the whole discussion when we went up to the legislature, I try to emphasize it was more than just about 2.5%. And everybody knows that. I mean, you'd have to be an idiot not to know that. It's more than 2.5%. We lost the insurance went way up, like I said, 130%. And I try to explain to the legislature how that impacted just me. But there is others just like me, no different. They're going through the same thing. I'm not the only one who has a child who suffers from a disability. He's autistic. So I'm trying to secure my future, my own future, plus his, plus my son's, because he's not going to be able to secure his own, which means what the state's doing with me and anybody else and other state workers is paramount. I can't even emphasize enough. We lost longevity. That's money. We lost cost of living. That's gone. Anybody notice the cost of living has gone up? It seems like every time I turn around, the price of this has gone up, and the price of that has gone up.
Everything's gone up, but
everything's got to mix up your pay.
Right. So let me ask you this.
That should bond people together. I would think that would bond people together. That would bring people together and put their differences aside. That's how I got involved about a year and a half ago. I was approached. I was always a union member. I'm from back east in Pennsylvania, born and bred and raised. I came out here 26 years ago. Got involved in a union years and years ago because I was being mistreated on the job. And I said that they would have my loyalty, the union. I was a union member back in Pennsylvania, and I was on a committee, union committee, that helped organize a union at a healthcare center. And it was a long fight. So I had that union in me. It's in me, but I'm a person, you got to show me. I'm from back here. Show me something, you know. Just don't talk a talk. Show me.
Right.
Then you'll have my loyalty. Okay? So I gave my loyalty. They delivered. And I said, well, you're going to have my loyalty, and you'll have my union dues. Now, from that point on until just about a year and a half or so ago, I just paid my dues. I didn't come down to the hall as often or as much at all.
What made you get active?
Well,
I mean, the dues part, that's all part of it. What made you step forward and do more?
Well, my son, my youngest son, my oldest son, who's unemployed. What is the youth unemployment rate? Oh, it's about 40. It's outrageous. It's shameful is what it is. It's shameful. We ought to be ashamed of ourselves. All of us, collectively, ought to be ashamed of ourselves. Because it wasn't that way when I was a kid. But it certainly is this way today.
Well, it can't help but be because we have the elderly working fast food places. We have people who should be home retiring, working because they had made minimum wage their whole lives, and now their benefit is $520 or $560 a month, and they can't live on it, so they're working at McDonald's.
I agree 100%. I may never retire. That's the reality of it. I may just have to work until they scrape me off the floor. You know? That's a sad thing. That's sad. I'm the baby boomer, okay? And we may never retire. We're just going to have to work until they scrape us off the floor, I guess, until...
Real quick, what's your state job? What job do you do for the state?
Well, I've done several things for the state. At first, I was first hired at the Department of Prisons, worked there for 8 years. And my job was a culinary cook supervisor of two, I supervised 80 inmates. It was a very dangerous job. It was a very stressful job. It was tough. I mean, I can't even adequately describe to you the stress, the anxiety, the tension.
You're working in a kitchen.
And I'm handing out knives. Yeah, I had to sign out knives to inmates, and I had to get them to put out food for 1,500 people and not have a riot, okay?
So we're giving them the weapons.
Okay. Now, I think my life is worth a lot more than whatever I was being paid. Okay, just like the correction.
I wouldn't do it.
Just the same thing as the correction officer, right? I don't see myself as a state worker per se. I'm a state worker, of course, but I see myself more as a public servant. We've gotten away from being a public servant first. That's what we are first, public servants. So I'm a veteran. I serve my country, and I still feel like I'm serving my country in a sense. Nevada belongs to the United States. Last time I checked, right? Nevada, right? All right. So since it belongs to the United States and I'm serving inside the state government, I'm in a way serving the country still, okay?
And the country should, in turn, help you, right?
I would think so. I would think so by making it possible for me to secure my future and that of my son who's not going to be able to. I can care less for myself. It's my son that I. You know, we're all like that, don't you?
Absolutely.
You care more for your own kids. You give your life for your kids, you know. And I want to see my son be able to be secure and not, I mean, in my last final days, worrying about whether or not he's going to be able to be taken care of, and whether or not he'll be abused or whatever.
I can't think of a something I'd be more afraid of than thinking I would die, not knowing what would happen to my children. Yeah. And so when you talk about this, and I think the thing you said was we used to care about each other. Can you put your finger on what happened? I mean, can you remember a time when that stopped? I mean, is it now that our neighbor is a different color or funny or no?
It has nothing to do with color. We all bleed the same way. We all get up and go to work the same way. We all suffer the same way. We all live the same. We're all born. We all die. Okay? None of us gets out of this alive. Okay? We're going to die. Okay?
So why have we forgotten each other?
Well, I have a personal Okay. I believe in the Lord Jesus Christ. Okay, I believe in God. And the people are ashamed to say that now. And if you'd have told me that 35, 40 years ago, when I was a young guy, I'd have said that, what? It's that bad. It's obvious, too. You'd have to be blind and stupid not to see it.
So people have been able to turn their back on each other, and in that turning their back on each other, they've been able to ridicule people who still care, like union members. So, and this is the poverty class picking on itself. Poverty class picking on the middle class, and the poverty class picking on itself. And I can't, for the life of me, find out why.
When everybody's divided, they all turn on each other, right? Is this not how this works, right? When everybody's divided, they're all divided against each other. And we are shocked. Why should we be shocked?
Well, it's nothing new. I mean,
it's nothing new. But it's gotten worse from the time, say, when I was 20, and now I'm 57. It's gotten far, far worse.
Well, I would say it's taken us back, the big circle that keeps going around. We're right back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
The 1880s and 1890s, where, you know, the Jay Goulds of the world roamed the earth and literally paid people to beat each other up and kill each other in the streets. So, I mean, it's perfect. You know, what you're saying about division is perfectly there. And I think it's going to take a lot of what you do and a lot of what your members do, the conversations we've had to get us back on the right track. And I think, judging with the people we've talked to, I think you're doing a great job down here in Las Vegas, and I look forward to hearing more about it.
I just became a president. I'm new, okay? So I got there's a learning curve for me, okay? I got some learning to do, okay? My heart's in it, that's for sure.
That's a start.
I have the passion. I care. I care for people. I care about what happens to people. I want to see people be able to stand on their own 2 feet, you know what I'm saying, and be able to feed themselves, clothe their families, you know, live the American dream. You know, the American dream. We used to talk about the American dream. Today we're like, what? What? What was that?
For many, too many, it's the American nightmare. Lou Lombardo, we appreciate you having us here. We appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure, and hope to see you again. And if you get back to Pennsylvania, tell them I said hello out there.
I most certainly will. Thanks, Lou.
You know, my favorite thing about this place and this guy and what they're doing here is you just heard a union leader, one of those thugs people like to talk about, just say, I care about people. I care about them feeding their kids and clothing their kids. And that's what being in a union's about.
Right there. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, get the podcast. Don't forget Stitcher for your smartphone. Also, you can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, email rick@thericksmithshow.com. We look forward to your questions, comments, thoughts of our tour across the country. I guess, Pat, the big question is, what do you think of our time in Las Vegas?
I loved it, except that it was beyond hot. You know, the heat was insufferable, and that made the work that they get done there even more impressive.
Yeah.
We talked to one man off air and never actually put him on air because he was just a little part-timer and didn't really feel comfortable joining us. But he said that when he was a young man, he worked on roofs in Las Vegas. Now, that to me is just being 40 feet closer to hell, if you know what I'm talking about.
Exactly.
You know? And he said that he kept his tools in a bucket of water. Otherwise, he couldn't touch them. If he kept his tools up on top of the roof, he couldn't hold them, so he kept them in a bucket of water. And from the time he reached his hand in to grab his tool and went to use it, it had dried. You know? It dried in seconds. And
yeah,
these people work their butts off in these kind of conditions.
I went to wash the windshield. We stopped to get gas and went to wash the windshield. By the time I turned over the squeegee from the sponge, it was dried.
Yeah, yeah. And all that soapy stuff was stuck to the window because it dried just that fast.
And I got to spend
20 minutes trying to get it off.
But that's the thing, is they work in these incredible, insufferable, they've built an entire, you know, community out there in the desert, and they're all sort of wonderfully interdependent, unless they work for the state. And then, well, screw them, quite frankly.
You know, as we talk to the people, you know, to Harry and to Lou and to the others, you know, you look at the laws that are in place in Nevada, and you know, I look at what Governor Corbett in Pennsylvania and what the Republicans are trying to do. They're trying to do to the workers in Pennsylvania what's been going on to these workers in Nevada for all these years, doing away with prevailing wage and changing. And I love the little death of a thousand paper cuts. Oh, we're not changing prevailing wage. We're just changing, you know, the word construction, changing the definition of construction. So any road maintenance, that's not really construction. So that's exempt. Anything that has to do with children, well, that's exempt. And you go, well, what are you trying to create? Well, you're trying to create what they've done in places like Nevada. And I just hope that people get what that means.
You know, the people, the same people who think it's okay to change the name, the definition of the word construction, are the people who are so horrified that Bill Clinton didn't consider that sex.
You mean, you know? Stephen Bloom?
Yeah. I mean, it is not sex. I tell you what, buddy, if any part of your private part is naked and is touching somebody else's anything, that's sex. And if you pick up a hammer and you swing it, it's construction. You know, or dig it with a shovel or anything.
There you go.
You know, you can't get away with something on one side and then say it's no good on the other side. You can't rip people's livelihoods out of their hands and say it's not construction and then insist that, you know, everybody else be completely upfront and honest. And that's the hypocrisy of it. And it's infuriating.
And the other part of this, you know, as we were talking to Lou, and we alluded to it in a couple other interviews, that the state workers in Nevada, holy, they don't have collective bargaining rights. And, you know, that's something that, boy, the Republicans in Pennsylvania would love to impose on state workers. You can have your union, you can have your little group, but you're not going to have any rights,
yeah.
And you're not going to have any power or any way to enforce wages, hours, or conditions. And I look at this and I go, it's exactly right down to the letter what the Republicans in Pennsylvania want.
And, you know, I've got to look it up. You know, I've got to do all this research for the book, but I got to look it up. I got to see when the last time the state of Nevada's legislature voted themselves a raise. Or any change in their benefits, because that was collective bargaining.
Yeah.
And when the legislature decides to give themselves a cost of living increase, anything, that's collective bargaining, because they do it together and they vote on it. And the only thing that's different between that collective bargaining and the workers, the state workers' collective bargaining, is that there's nobody talking to the legislature on the other side. Their decisions go into the great big vacuum of the voting booth where nobody decides to throw the bums out.
And I'm a big fan of exercising your right to term limits.
Yeah. Throw the bums out. If they don't let you, if they even talk about not allowing people to collective bargain in Pennsylvania or anywhere else, and you know they're going to vote their own raises in, they need to go.
I'm right there with you.
They need to go.
But I enjoyed our time in Las Vegas. I thought it was extremely productive, eye-opening for me. There were a lot of things that I learned, and I hope you did, too. If you missed any portion of our program, thericksmithshow.com, you can get the podcast or Stitcher on your smartphone. Also, you can go to the People's Tour for America. As the People's Tour for America rambles on down the road, we're heading to Los Angeles.
No. Oh, yeah, we are.
Heading to Los Angeles next. Going to talk to some Teamsters, some AFSCME workers. I'm going to get the history of Los Angeles. I'm really interested in that in the coming days. And, of course, if you've missed any portion, thericksmithshow.com, peoplestourforamerica.com. We'll be back from the road. This is The Rick Smith Show.
I'll move somewhere. Maybe I'll get